A week of foul-tempered debate in Europe ended this afternoon as finance ministers agreed new quota rates for trade with the United States. In Brussels is our economics correspondent, Peter O'Hanrahan. Peter, what is the new rate?
It's 30%, Chris. Agreement was a long time coming, but in the end, the decision was unanimous.
What was the Germans' reaction? Because they've been holding out for 40%, haven't they?
That's right. When I spoke to Finance Minister Reinhardt earlier today, he said he didn't like the deal, but he had to go along with it.
Really? You spoke to him yourself. You managed to pin him down. He's a pretty tricky man, isn't he?
That's right.
Where did you get hold of him?
He was in the hotel.
And you conducted a conversation with him about the quota rates?
That's right. He said he didn't like it, but he had to go along with it.
What language did you conduct this conversation in, Peter?
German.
You spoke to him about the technicalities of the deal in German?
Yes.
So what's the German for 30%?
30%er.
30%?
Yes.
And what about that quote you attributed to him? I don't like it, but I'll have to go along with it.
That's what he said.
How did he say it?
I don't like it, but I'll have to go along with it.
In German, how did he say it?
Ich nichten lichten.
Presumably you mean, rufen Sie ein Taxi bitte, sonst verpasse ich meinen Flug.
Yes.
No, you don't, Peter, because that means, get me a taxi, I'm late for my plane. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Did you speak to the German finance minister about the new deal this afternoon?
No.
And what was his reaction?
I don't know.
Peter, thank you.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 24th of January 2025. From Bristol, one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. Templars, of course, busy at it again, aren't they, ever since World War II in the State of Israel. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or Apple App Store, but not Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero-trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions. Puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes. Twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. We'll be hearing quite a bit more about that. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and the vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people, as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS. Some people say, I heard someone this week saying, well, Charlie doesn't have any power. Oh, only the power to appoint army officers, intelligence officers, police officers, ministers, judges. No, no power at all. Panda-eyed energy saboteur Secretary Ed Miliband seems to be the chief accelerationist minister right now. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. Helping us to navigate the accelerationist Wef Fourth Reich matrix, I'm afraid, is no Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Once more, just me this week. We'll be back in February as Dave's off on his holidays. We've got several main topics this week. Number one of which is going to be the ceasefire. Then number two, we'll be looking at Prince Harry's settlement with Rupert Murdoch. Then Donald Trump's inauguration. And then we have a special all about artificial intelligence with a really fascinating insight into why they're absolutely obsessed with this right now. So before we get stuck in, I'd like to just share with you a post about child abuse going on and grooming and rape going on within the Labour Party. I will share a list of 17 different Labour politicians since 2020 who've been convicted of child pornography, online grooming. There's a whole list, really, various child offences. One of them, ex-Shadow Minister Eric Joyce. But there's a whole list of MPs and councillors from the Labour Party. I'm sure other parties have got them too, but 17 within the Labour Party. The suggestion here is that, hang on, if you're blackmailable with child porn, then you could become a rising star in the Labour Party. And there's certain indications that, that's exactly what's happening. So the Labour apparatchiks are identifying those that can be blackmailed and pushing them up within the party. Quite fascinating. Also, another story I found really good this week, because, I mean, this is the trouble. With all the clips, it's impossible to really do, you know, individual stories. So this is one of the latest about AI. We'll be talking about AI later. AI is already using as much energy as a country. It's only the beginning. This is an article in Vox. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But more importantly, Microsoft, who are helping the Israeli Defence Force, they've just done a deal to offset their AI emissions and to restore the rainforest, they say. So actually what they're really doing is investing $200 million in reforestation in Brazil, which is what's fueling a lot of this farm attacks, is the idea that they've got these massive companies coming up now, buying up land to do this carbon offset. So the money is just being funneled out of Microsoft so it doesn't then get taxed. This is this is, what do they call it when it's not be, it's part of the, oh, it's tax exempt, you know, it's sort of tax exempt. So if you're spending money on this, that means that your amount of your paying in tax is going to go down. So it's an allowable expense, business expense, to buy up land. Oh God. So there's a couple of stories, but let's get plunged straight in with this look at the ceasefire. We're going to start this week on a slightly peculiar angle, going back to the 1990s. Actually, the Bishopsgate bomb on Saturday, the 24th of April, 1993, which did £500 million worth of damage and brought the British government under John Major to the negotiating table with the IRA. There'd already been a ceasefire at this point with the IRA, but the British government were being very, very intransigent and very slow. So the IRA decided, right, let's just explode a series of truck bombs. Well, they eventually ended up exploding three in the city of London, in and around the city of London. And that finally forced the hand of what was eventually the Blair government to do the Good Friday Agreement. So here is Annie Machon, former MI5 officer, talking about that Bishopsgate attack. Fascinating, this.
I was given the desk to investigate Irish terrorist logistics. So it wasn't just the Republicans, it was also the Loyalists too. So we were trying to stop the infiltration, exfiltration of personnel and material into and out of the UK. So I had to work a lot with organisations like the customs and ports police and people like that.
I would imagine that's extremely high pressure, because obviously when you're dealing with a terrorist organisation, especially one who was as active as the IRA was around that time with bombings and all the rest of it, was there that sense of, as I said, pressure with making sure that you were on top of everything? And I know you've mentioned that, you know, there was a bombing that happened that shouldn't have happened or could have been avoided.
Yes, Bishopsgate in 1993. It was a lorry bomb that decimated the city of London. And there were opportunities to stop the attack before it happened, and they were missed. And therefore the bomb went off and a person died and many people were injured. It was terrible. It was a huge explosion.
That's a big one. That is a huge bomb.
Good evening. A tipper truck packed with explosives went off in the city of London this morning. It killed one man and injured more than 40 other people. The bomb exploded in Bishopsgate near the NatWest Tower.
The column of smoke rising above the city skyline left Londoners in little doubt about the size of the blast. The shockwave was felt over a wide area, the explosion heard several miles away.
The key point that really perturbed my partner, as well as me, was the fact that they lied about it afterwards. In MI5, because they are supposed to be accountable to the Home Secretary, who's supposed to, you know, sign them off to do all sorts of stuff. And they covered up the mistakes they'd made. So I think thereby you don't, an organization cannot learn from their mistakes. And by learning from your mistakes, you can improve how you work, rather than just brushing them under the carpet. So that was the key problem there.
So that's former MI5 officer Annie Machon speaking recently about the Bishopsgate bomb on Saturday, the 24th of April, 1993, which did £500 million worth of damage. The fact that MI5 were just kind of watching it happen. I always remember in Punch, David Shaler published an article. He said, well, actually, we could see the CCTV and the people from the IRA, as they got out of the truck bomb and walked away, were waving at the cameras. So there you go. Complicity, the security services in terrorism. Never, surely not. So back to the ceasefire, the one in Gaza, which is arranged just before the day of Trump's inauguration. Funny coincidence that, but over 100,000 people attended a pro-Palestine march in central London last Saturday.
We need to be here, and we will be here as long as it takes, until all Israeli forces are withdrawn from Gaza and a commitment to end the occupation of the West Bank and the settlement policy. We're here to support the Palestinian people and recognise the horrendous suffering that the people of Gaza have been through.
There's genocide taking place, which my government is complicit in. It's armed and facilitated it. And I'm here, frankly, because I work in the Western media industry, which is complicit in the genocide. One of the great crimes of our age, more evidence than confessed to as it happened than any crime in history. That we have a respite, hopefully, in the form of a ceasefire, although, as we speak, Palestinians are still being slaughtered and butchered, including those who celebrated the ceasefire. But Gaza's been reduced to apocalyptic ruin.
We know that this did not start on October the 7th, and actually there have been decades and decades of an occupation. So it's really, really important that that stays on the agenda. Now, when it comes to the ceasefire, this is hopeful news, and I think we do need to have some hope about a step forward. It has taken far too long. Far too many innocent lives have been lost. But ultimately, we also need to make sure that we keep both parties in this to stick to the agreement. And ultimately, this is about people all around the country and all around the world coming together to saying we need to make sure that there is peace in the Middle East.
It's in Gaza, months that will haunt us all. And it's a duty for all of us to continue coming out, because we know that a ceasefire is not the end, it's only the beginning.
And what do you see coming in the next few weeks following this ceasefire? Are you optimistic?
I mean, we have to be optimistic, and I think this is a moment of hope. But at the same time, it also must be a moment for everyone here to renew their commitment to the ongoing struggle for freedom and justice for the Palestinian people. This ceasefire, we hope it will hold, but we all know that our Palestinian tragedy will not end when the bombs stop falling. It ends when the Palestinian people are free. And that is why our movement has to continue.
Significant restrictions at that march last Saturday included the fact they weren't allowed to march to the BBC, which they'd arranged well beforehand, because two blocks away from the BBC is a synagogue, and the police decided to say that was too close and it could be a terrorist offence in order to go anywhere near the synagogue. So,
my name is Tony Greenstein. I'm a Jewish anti-Zionist. I'm an activist on Palestine. I'm the author of the book Zionism During the Holocaust. And my claim to credit is being the first Jewish person to be expelled from the Labour Party.
Now, you've had some issues down in Brighton recently with this guy, Ivor Kaplan. Can you tell us what's been going on and why it's so significant?
Well, Ivor Kaplan was the former MP for Hove. He was the first ever Labour MP for Hove from 1997 to 2005. And he was made a junior defence minister by Tony Blair. And he was there during the invasion of Iraq. And he was made a minister for veterans until he suddenly resigned in 2004, I think it was. And Labour had to find a replacement very quickly. But he was a Labour MP for, the best part of 8 years, I would say.
Now, he's been filmed really confessing effectively, even though there may be a court case. I don't think he's been charged yet. Maybe you can tell us whether he has or not. Do you know?
As far as I'm aware, there has been no charge at all.
But anyway, he was filmed by some people who were saying you were trying to meet a schoolboy in a train station, grooming them, basically. And there doesn't seem to have been very much action by the police. Now, we're seeing the similar sort of thing going on. I mean, it might be a stretching a point to make the comparison. But so we've just heard Rupert Murdoch making an out-of-court settlement with Prince Harry and Tom Watson. And they're saying effectively, oh, by the way, we perjured ourselves all the way through the phone hacking inquiry. I mean, there seems to be a bit of a problem with political policing these days.
Well, the Met has their hands full trying to suppress Palestinian demonstrations and taking away our freedom of speech. I mean, when I was arrested in a Dawn raid over a year ago, about a dozen police came round with bans, you know. So their resources are thinly spread and they're concentrating more on attacking protesters and supporters of the Palestinians than minor matters like child sex offences, rape, which, you know, I mean, rape has virtually been decriminalised in Britain. I mean, your chances of being convicted and sent to prison for rape are minuscule, I think less than 1%. So, I mean, the police have to choose their priorities, and for the government, the clear priority is supporting the genocide in Palestine and not, you know, what Ivor Kaplan is up to in his spare time, or it would seem full time, really. So, yes, he was caught in the sting by a vigilante group that specialises in this. Of course, the police wouldn't have done any such thing, even though Ivor Kaplan seems to have a psychological problem. I mean, his Twitter feed was just filled with pictures of naked men, penises erect, and so on and so forth. I mean, I've reprinted some of it on my blog, but with a clear warning to people who might be otherwise offended. But all of this, it was just a sewer, really, an overflowing sewer. But none of his colleagues, Tom Watson followed him, Gordon Brown followed him, all sorts of illustrious people followed Ivor Kaplan, and no one said a dickies birds, not least, of course, his ex-boyfriend and successor in Hove, Peter Kyle MP. So, yes, I mean, there's been a kind of silence over Kaplan and his activities for quite some time.
Now I understand that you know, the police came around to your house, you know, their proceedings against you over this idea of a proscribed organization, but I wonder if you're allowed to tell us about this. There seems to be a list of proscribed organizations. Trump has added to the list yesterday by adding the Yemeni government to the list of proscribed terrorist organizations. So we're now in a situation where one of the main actors internationally against the genocide that's been going on in Gaza, that is to say Ansarallah and the Houthis, who are now running Yemen, that they are now apparently proscribed in a similar way to Hamas is proscribed. Something's going on here, Tony.
Yes, I mean, it's called the Terrorism Act, but it's not about terrorism. It's about who your political enemies are, in a sense. I mean, the Houthis could be accused of being the only government in the world which is trying to enforce international law against Israel, which is, you know, in Gaza, it's not been waging a war on Hamas, which is underground in safely in tunnels, as we saw when lots of them came out to escort the Israeli prisoners. They've been waging a war on the population, unless you really fall for the idea that Hamas had a base in every hospital, a command and control center in every hospital, in every school, in every reservoir that they've blown up and so on. Israel has been committing a whole series of war crimes and a genocide in Gaza. But if you support the resistance to the Israel, then that makes you an offender under British law. I mean, that's the upside down world we live in.
Well, I must make it clear, I do support the resistance to genocide, any genocide, no matter who's committing it personally, and there are millions of us that do. So I wonder if there's enough space in Britain's prisons for us all, Tony.
Well, I don't think they'll be arresting everybody. I think what they want to do is cut off the heads of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, those people who articulate those feelings clearly. And they've gone for people like me, Natalie Strecker, Sarah Wilkinson, a journalist, Richard Medhurst, another journalist, and they've raided the house of Asa Winstanley of Electronic Intifada. So they are clearly attacking particular individuals in the hope that that will terrorise, to use a word, the rest of you into being silent.
I think we finally got to the bottom of what the Terrorism Act is really all about, spreading terrorism.
Yes. Yes.
We had a demonstration in central London on Saturday, really was picking up on the expose by Owen Jones and many others of the direct involvement of CIA front organisations in the BBC, Tony.
Well, quite, yes. I mean, government organisations are all over the BBC. We know that the Zionists are heavily involved, whether it's Rathberger, who came from the CIA, or any other individual. The BBC's coverage is skewed because we know that the BBC are really, at one stage removed, the voice of the British establishment, and they reflect it in the language they use, the way they focus. For instance, when there was a hostage exchange, they focused on Israeli hostages, but not the thousands of Palestinian hostages who Israel's taken. I mean, that is the balance that we come to expect and love from the BBC. And naturally, the police saw it as their duty to protect them. And so they came out with this absurdly thin pretext that the marches were a threat to synagogues. We didn't even know where the synagogues were, and why should they be a threat? Are they implying that the marches are anti-Jewish? I mean, the whole thing stinks. The Met has been found lying through their teeth. And Sir Mark Rowley has to go. He is a dishonest Met commissioner who's lied, lied and lied again. And the next day he appeared before the Board of Deputies to boast about what he'd done. The Board of Deputies is an outspoken supporter of Israel's genocide, except they deny that it is a genocide, of course.
Can you tell us a bit more about the Board of Deputies of British Jews? Because this is an organisation which much of the establishment, certainly the London media, seem to accept is the voice of Judaism here in Britain, or Jewishness.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Board of Deputies doesn't represent secular Jews like myself. It has written into its constitution unstinting support for Israel. It's not elected. It consists of synagogue representatives, and only a minority of Jewish people in Britain go to synagogues. It doesn't represent the ultra-Orthodox. So at best, it represents about 30% of British Jews. But it's always been the chosen instrument of the British establishment.
Look, we had all these arrests on Saturday of people for going near to the BBC. You know, what they're being told is that they're being arrested because they are potentially terrorists, effectively, and there are so many now being arrested. Now, this was just on Saturday afternoon, but being bundled into police vehicles. One of them was just taking a message and a bunch of flowers to the BBC reception, and they're arrested for that.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Well, firstly, policemen aren't known for their ability to think about consequences. But secondly, of course, if an order is given to protect the BBC, that means protect it from the public. And so anyone who attempts on that occasion to approach them will be arrested. I mean, that, if you like, is part of what it was about. They were there to put a ring of steel around the BBC. So we see quite clearly the police know very well the role that the BBC plays, and they're there to ensure that no one gets any near it. I mean, what greater proof can you have that the BBC is anything but a neutral broadcasting station? So, I mean, in that sense, they've done our job for us. But the collaboration between the supporters of genocide and the Metropolitan Police, I should think, demonstrates that the police's claim to be neutral doesn't have a shred of justification.
Now, I know the concentration on the BBC by demonstrators is because it's supposed to be publicly accountable, but arguably, I would suggest that the Murdoch empire, that is to say things like Talk TV, Fox in the United States, etc., And of course, their newspapers and radio stations, they are even more pro-Israeli. In fact, they absolutely refuse to even entertain the possibility that a genocide could be going on. And Murdoch himself seems to have some very close interests in Israel, financial interests, as well as very, very close ties. So I wonder what you make of the fact yesterday that Murdoch's decided to pay this seven-figure sum to Tom Watson and to Prince Harry to keep any of this evidence of criminal activity out of the courts.
Well, that's right, of course. Literally, the Murdoch Empire, which, of course, the police in past years in the Whopping dispute and so on have done their level best to protect, is a criminal enterprise. And yet there's been virtually no police investigation of what went on, because these are crimes, hacking phones, computers and so on are criminal enterprises. But
well, what Alan Rushbridger has also pointed out is that it's quite obvious and clear now, as of yesterday, that the Murdoch Empire and their employees have been perjuring themselves for the last decade by pretending this isn't going on. They've now admitted to Harry and Watson that it has.
Yes, I'm sure that's absolutely true. So is there going to be an investigation of the testimony given by these witnesses on oath? And then prosecutions for perjury? I very much doubt it, because the police are more concerned with current day-to-day events and suppressing free speech and the right of peaceful assembly. I mean, that is the police's priorities. When it comes down to it, the coercive duties of the police, which is called preserving the king's peace, come above everything. So when they talk about community policing, we know at the end of the day that it means anything but that.
Fascinating. Anyway, Tony, for people interested in following you, finding you, reading your blog, etc., buying your book, where's the best place to find you?
If you want to find me, if you want to buy the book, tonygreenstein104@gmail.com. If you want to follow my blog, www.azvsas.blogspot.com or tonygreenstein.com is my shadow blog, because I have another one just in case Google winds up my first one. So that's where you would find me.
So then we have a listen now to Piers Corbyn, who was actually arrested last Saturday. He's well known, brother of Jeremy Corbyn, activist in London, an astrophysicist, and he will talk about astrophysics and things like that in the longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And so here he is, as he was stopped by the police, as he explains what happened at the London demo last Saturday.
The demo was going to start at BBC. PSC agreed it should start in Whitehall, and their plan was to march to the BBC. The police said you can't do that, and put a no-go area in Trafalgar Square.
But well, they said you can't do it. Let's just be clear, because there is a synagogue nearby the BBC.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Now, of course, the Trafalgar Square and Whitehall are miles from that synagogue. So that was crazy, but they imposed this condition that you can't stay around in Trafalgar Square. So people who went into Trafalgar Square weren't allowed out, because they were obviously going to go to the BBC. And the whole area, the whole of it, all exits and entrances to Trafalgar Square and Whitehall were closed off by a massive police operation. Police were 10 deep outside some of these exits and entrances. It's a vast thing. Anyway, people who hung around and refused to leave Trafalgar Square when asked got arrested. And some of us left and went on our own volition as individuals to the BBC. I went there and I was confronted by the police, who said, "You are a serious danger to life and community here." And I said, "Look," and I was holding a bunch of flowers, symbolically of people, children killed in Gaza, and his protest against BBC misinformation. I wanted to present them to the BBC. And he repeated, "You here staying here is a serious disruption of life and community. Will you go? I said, look, I just need to go to the BBC to give them these flowers. And I don't accept that this is serious disruption of any life and community. And I was then arrested and spent 15 hours in police cells. And that, my trial is coming up.
Where did they take you? What's it like being arrested? What do they do?
Easington Police Station. They had about five police stations taking people. They'd arrested prisoners. And my case is on the 17th of February, or the initial hearing for it. There's obviously about 70 or so other cases. Maybe they're coming on that date. I'm not completely sure. I think some might be coming up on the 13th or 14th of February.
So you're quite used to being arrested, but most of the listeners probably haven't been. What sort of experience is it?
Well, the police are very, very polite with me because they know that I know my rights, and they're very helpful. But mostly in these sort of circumstances, to be quite fair, the policemen involved know it's all nonsense, and they know they're put there for, you know, ridiculous things. So they're just suppressing free speech.
But that's quite annoying, them being nice. It's like, you know, we're arresting you with a big smile on our face.
Yes, exactly. That's not being nice, no. But they treated me reasonably. They didn't handcuff me. I don't know if they handcuffed others. They probably did in Trafalgar Square because there was a lot of people. So they like to handcuff people in a crowd to warn others, you see. But in the police station, I was treated well and given as much food as I wanted. Not that it's nice food, but anyway, and cups of tea and so forth. And then eventually interviewed, and off you go at 9 o'clock in the morning. So that was 15 hours later.
So still potentially facing charges and a court, but one does wonder if that will ever happen. I can't help but think maybe not. Maybe it won't. Anyway, so that was Piers Corbyn, and here he is again talking about something coming up at the moment which they're campaigning on, called the Climate and Nature Bill.
We've got a Telegram group called Can the Can Bill. So Can the Can Bill, C-A-N, can, Climate and Nature. So Telegram group Can the Can Bill. Just type in C-A-N and you'll get there. Otherwise, come to @Piers_Corbyn on Twitter. And the Climate and Nature Bill is a bill designed to bring all of these things they want into law, such as ending all use of diesel and petrol cars, ending air flight, reducing or essentially ending farming. I mean, it is complete, utter insanity, and it means destruction of the economy and includes carbon footprinting, which means artificial intelligence will then monitor your carbon footprint and prevent you spending certain things on certain things or prevent you leaving your zone and so on. It's about, I would say, it's creeping green fascism, and it has to be stopped. People who are following this do not understand where they're going. They're being misled big time.
If this Climate and Nature Bill is passed, where are we going to be in 10 years' time?
Well, we'll be breaking the law. We'll be defying it everywhere. But if they have their way, we'll have the end of farming. We'll have factory-made food, whatever that entails, or importing food. We'll have carbon footprinting, and you'll be limited in your movements, not allowed to enter buildings or go to places if you've overstepped your carbon footprint. And and so it goes on. You won't be able to fly anywhere either. They will have cancelled airfares, air flight by then. That's what they want. It's all in their desire. They're mentally insane. Let's understand it. These people are clinically mad.
London activist Piers Corbyn there talking about the Climate and Nature Bill, where there's an ongoing campaign there. He seems to think it's going to be a pretty devastating. The idea is that by signing the Paris Accords, the British government have committed themselves to legislating. Well, they've been doing it enthusiastically under the Tories and under Labour. But the Americans, of course, have not only said we're not going to actually do the legislation, but they've also now pulled out of the Paris Accords completely. So there's an interesting tension developing across the Atlantic on these
energy issues. And Piers Corbyn's interview, I'll put the full interview up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. So on the ceasefire, I did get in contact this week with a chap we mentioned briefly last week, Ben Abrahamson. And I think I sent his paper out with the newsletter last week too. Here he is. He's a LA-born rabbi who lives in Jerusalem, a peace seeker, and a Zionist. He doesn't like calling himself a Zionist. He certainly believes that the Jews should be in that part of the world, and he explains why in the interview. But I asked him about Zionism, because there's so many different terms here. There's the Zionist movement. There are extreme and non-extreme versions. There's also religious Zionists and political Zionists. How do you pull them all apart, Ben?
The word Zionism means so many different things to so many different people, you know, from controlling the press and the world banks down to, you know, to running governments, puppet governments. I mean, it's I don't even know how you can define it. What I can say that living in Israel is part of Judaism. You know, if you compare it to Islam, Islam has Mecca, which is called the Qibla, the direction that's where you pray, and that's, you know, the center of all the holidays and everything. And Judaism has exactly the same thing in the Torah. I mean, the Jerusalem is the cent, it is the Qibla. It's exactly like the Mecca for the people who keep Torah. You pray in that direction. The holidays are there. You're only allowed to just, you know, all the commandments in the Torah are, you know, 90% of them are supposed to be done in the area around that Qibla, that center place, which for us is Jerusalem. So, I mean, it's just part of the religion that you should want to live in Israel. And from a religious point of view, you know, when I hear the people who, the anti-Zionists, Satmar and the Turikarti, this kind of thing, you know, every time I hear that, I remember that the anger that they feel over the what happened to the Jewish Agency, where they did not spend as much effort saving the Hungarian Jews as other people felt they should have. And the anger is just seething through. It's not because these people who are these black-hatted people who are anti-Zionists love Palestinians so much. It's just that they really hate the Jewish Agency. But as far as Zionism in general, from a religious point of view, that's started, as far as I know, from the Ottoman Empire. You know, you're back when they kicked Jews out of Spain. The first people to help start settling Jews in the Holy Land were the Ottomans. So this has been going on for a long time. You know, even in Tiberias, the Jewish people were able to get a firman to have almost a little autonomy area in the city of Tiberia by the Sea of Galilee. So it's you know, terms are very laden with meaning. And if you ask me about Zionism, I say I don't know about Zionism. What I know about is Jewish people are commanded by God to do commandments, and these commandments apply in the land of Israel.
There is this Amidah prayer, which is said in the synagogues, actually said in the homes of devout Jews as well, which has been around for quite a while. This is all about the return to Jerusalem.
Hashivenu, yeah, exactly. Bring us back to the land and rebuild the temple and stuff like that. What people should know, though, that the Jewish idea of rebuilding the temple is very different than the Christian idea. The Christian idea is based on revelations, that if you want all the events in Revelation to happen, they all presuppose that in Jerusalem you'll have a functioning temple with a high priest and sacrifice. I mean, a functioning temple. And the easiest way to do that is to have a temple that looked like it did back in Herod's time. But that's not the Jewish point of view. The Jewish point of view is that we were commanded to make sacrifices. We were commanded to, you know, the daily sacrifices, weekly sacrifices, Sabbath sacrifices, these kind of things. Just like, you know, in Islamic, you don't have sacrifices, but you have what they call qurbani, where you sacrifice a lamb or a camel or something. And these things are, this is what we need to do. And there's, the Temple Mount is 1 square kilometer. And there's really no reason why that area couldn't be shared. I mean, the current situation is sort of like, if you can imagine the Vatican taking over the Mecca and saying, all right, no Muslims allowed. You're not allowed to come here. You can't do pilgrimage here. You can't do your pilgrimage rites here. Nothing. You're forbidden from coming here. I mean, that would be a very difficult situation. And in Judaism, it's the same thing. I mean, here is the center point of our religion is forbidden. On the other hand, Judaism is aware that this is a very important place to both Christianity and Islam, which came out of Judaism. So there should be a way to work out to share this. But people don't, you know, they don't usually talk about that. But the truth is, there's absolutely no reason why the Temple Mount couldn't be shared. And in fact, this is I bring down in some of the research that I've been doing is that the Abd Malik, who built the Dome of the Rock, was in a lot of ways following Ezekiel when he built that. I mean, he thought at the time he was building Ezekiel's temple. You look at the
it
coins
makes
that
it
he
clear, the Dome of the Rock is actually supposedly in the way, isn't it, of the rebuild?
No, that's what I'm saying. It's not in the way. The Dome of the Rock is over where the Holy of Holies is. And in Jewish, you know, that's a place in Jewish tradition. You go there once a year on the high holidays, and that's it. You know, you never go there. The Holy of Holies, you know, that's the Dome of the Rock is the center point for prayer, but it's not the place where the commandments, where the celebrations are, which are done to the right of it. You have the Dome of the Rock, then you have the Dome of the Chain, and then after that you have a very, very large area, and that would be the area where the Jews would be doing things.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that you've got the three Abrahamic faiths have their Sabbath days on different days. So you've got the Jews on a Saturday, the Christians on a Sunday, and the Muslims on a Friday. Maybe you could have the same building, which becomes a center of prayer on those different days.
Absolutely. But you also you don't need the building. Like I said, the Temple Mount is 1 square kilometer. It's huge. It's really huge. They play football on it. I mean, it's soccer. The place which is interesting to the Jewish people is there currently is nothing there, and there would be nothing to prevent the Jews to completely fulfill all their dreams and hopes and wishes while leaving everything intact that's there today without making a single change in what exists today.
Rabbi Ben Abrahamson there, speaking to me earlier this week. He's a peace-seeking Jerusalem-based Zionist. I call him a Zionist. He doesn't. Rabbi. And he talks in the longer interview about his paper, Signs of the End and the Messiah. I think it's something like that. Anyway, that paper, I think I probably should send it out this week too. So ceasefire having happened just about, let's move on to look at Prince Harry. This week's settlement has been a long time coming. Harry has said it's his kind of life's work, basically, to get some kind of apology and admission of guilt from the Rupert Murdoch empire. We're going to have a good look at that. Here, it's first of all, is a news report on this week's monumental victory against the Sun's publisher.
I think without this apology, there is very little chance that Prince Harry was going to settle. But it's worth pointing out that this trial had huge reputational risks for News Group newspapers, for the senior executives that were potentially going to be named in allegations, which, of course, News Group newspapers denied. And that's why Prince Harry wanted to take this to trial. He wanted News Group newspapers finally in open court to have to talk about the unlawful activities of reporters at the News of the World and also at The Sun. And while at the News of the World back in 2011, there had been some level of apology to individuals who had their phones hacked, certainly with The Sun newspaper, there has never been any admission that unlawful activities were being carried out. It is worth pointing out that within this apology, it does say it is also acknowledged, but without any admission of illegality, that News Group newspapers' response to the 2006 arrests and subsequent actions were regrettable. So there are caveats within that apology. But also, in terms of what this means for Prince Harry, and just really to hammer home how significant this case was, look, we just have to look back over the last couple of years. When he released his book, Spare, he talked about how this was no longer just a personal issue for him. This was now going to be his life's work in terms of holding the tabloid press to account.
So Prince Harry and Tom Watson have won. I've heard from a very good source, who started the phone hacking story originally and pursued it. It's a 7-figure sum they've got So that's quite a lot of money, 10 million, something like that, up to 10 million. So that's quite a bit. I mean, I don't know if other papers have reported that, but I did get it from the horse's mouth, actually. Someone very, very well placed to who wasn't doing interviews, but he did tell me over the phone, bless him. So that is a basic report on what happened. So this week on the Today programme, we had Alan Rushbridger, didn't we? Rushbridger is the former editor of The Guardian, and he was running these stories about phone hacking. He was also doing a lot of stuff on Julian Assange, and then they were sort of shut down, basically, by the security services, by intelligence services. The Guardian was stopped from doing that, and the character of the paper has changed immensely. He's now editor as Prospect, but he had some very interesting things to say about the criminality of what Harry has uncovered here in this admission from News Group, it's called now, not News International, News Group, Murdoch's Empire.
Well, this is the most powerful newspaper group in the country. It's had great influence over public life and politics for 40, 50 years now. And the chief executive is Rebecca Brooks, who was editor of The Sun from 2003 to 2009, which has now been admitted to being running criminal activities at the time that she was editor. So it's not really finished. And it's difficult to think of any parallel in corporate life where the chief executive would be accused of these kind of activities and would still be there, and the regulator would do nothing. So that's why I say it's really a question as to whether we want to normalize this kind of behavior, shrug, say, well, it's been going on for a long time, let's leave it behind, or whether the authorities really have to do something.
Which, in your view, because you're essentially obviously saying the paper did illegal stuff, and there was a cover-up of that illegal stuff going on at The Sun. It's taken years for it to come out. Which is the more serious charge, in your view, the sin or the cover-up?
Well, I think media, legacy media, as we were forced to call ourselves nowadays, is in some trouble because people don't trust us. And I think for such a prominent media organization, not only to have indulged in this kind of criminal behavior, but to have lied about it consistently for so long, it is really damaging to the cause of journalism as a whole. And I think we need to know, first of all, whether lies were told to the Leveson inquiry, whether lies were told to MPs. And I think MPs need to really ask themselves as to the evidence that would have emerged in court, that the MPs on the Culture Media Select Committee that was looking at Murdoch were themselves subject to having their communications intercepted. Is that okay? Are we happy with that? Is that something that we're just going to let lie? Or are people going to actually not allow this to just wither with this judgment today?
All right. Alan Rushbridger, thank you for that.
So that was Alan Rushbridger. There's a full version of that, which I'll put up later, speaking to the Today programme about this verdict of, well, it's an out-of-court settlement, isn't it? And he does like to settle out of court, Murdoch. He doesn't want any of this information coming out to the public domain. He's really running a cult, a secret cult, rather than just a newspaper. Remember the Tucker Carlson business with Dominion Voting, who sued him in the United States. He settled out of court. He always settles out of court. He doesn't want these things being dragged through the courts, whereas you'll often find, say, for example, there's an Associated Newspapers Daily Mirror case, which is going through the courts, where people are having to disclose things to the judges and to the public on both sides. So they're not afraid to do that. Murdoch is. So Harry's done very well in getting this seven-figure sum, along with Tom Watson, out of Rupert Murdoch. But the thing is, the public are none the wiser. In a way, Harry has failed in his own mission. He's made a lot of money for himself, but he hasn't managed to get the knowledge about what Murdoch was up to, running his own little intelligence outfit, effectively, through The Sun and the News of the World. So who should we ask about that? Obviously, the person to talk to is Kevin Cahill. So I did track Kevin Carhill down this week. He talks about Murdoch as an organised crime organisation, and he should know. He worked for their own Sunday Times Insight team. He was the deputy editor of the Rich List on there, and he worked back in the 1980s for several years for Murdoch.
My name is Kevin Carhill. I'm a former deputy editor of the Sunday Times Rich List. I worked in Wapping, and I knew what was going on there. Indeed, at one stage, I reported to my boss at the Sunday Times that the News of the World was engaged in criminal misconduct in Parliament. Yesterday, what's important about yesterday is Prince Harry and Tom Watson got an admission from News UK that the Sun newspaper had engaged in illegal misconduct. The Sun has always denied this, including to Parliament and to the courts. So the admission is that the Sun has committed perjury regularly. Now, the next thing that's important is the Metropolitan Police have simply said they've noted what's happened in the court. That is grotesque. The Metropolitan Police are saying, well, yes, we realise, well, they're not saying that. The Metropolitan Police have not admitted that the admission by the Sun is an admission of perjury. There's more as well. The Metropolitan Police last in July said that they were investigating a complaint from a Mr. Brown. The Mr. Brown was Gordon Brown, a senior member of the Privy Council, and he complained about what happened to him, but he also complained that evidence at the Sun and the News and at News International have been suppressed and deleted. The suppression and deletion of evidence at News International and at The Sun was ordered by Rupert Murdoch. The person who executed his order was his managing editor, Stuart Kuttner, and the Metropolitan Police know this. So the attitude of the Metropolitan Police is grotesque.
So, Kevin, have you got any idea why the Met are behaving like this? You would have thought that they would be feeling collars straight away.
And originally, the most bribes paid in the United Kingdom by News International or News UK or whatever it calls itself, were paid to the Metropolitan Police. And what I am told is it's people who received those bribes who are blocking the investigation. The only evidence I have is what I reported to the Met Police back in 2000.
Okay, well, can you take us through what you thought was going on and what people had told you?
I was unusual down there. I had a parliamentary pass, so I had a completely independent view. And I was conscious of staff from the News of the World and the Sun running around blackmailing people, members of parliament, staff. And it was a trade in blackmail. You know, if you don't give us this, we would report you in the paper. The Sun and the News of the World were used as instruments of criminal blackmail. But that was admitted yesterday. That's what's critical. So it's not an issue of what I knew or who told. The Sun has always claimed, and the Sun's former editor, Rebecca Brooks, told the court that there was no illegal conduct. She said she was running, and I quote, a clean ship. Well, yesterday, News International admitted she wasn't. And Rebecca Brooks must have known what was going on. She was the editor.
I mean, I wonder who's most culpable here, because obviously the police are for taking the bribes, but maybe the police are genuinely worried that Murdoch organisation has got dirt on them, and if they were to speak out or to try and actually action this crime, do something about it, that they would find themselves splashed all over the newspapers in some sort of scandal.
Well, splashed all over the courts is much more likely. The suppression of evidence, which is a perversion, is the crime of perverting the course of justice, was ordered by Rupert Murdoch. I was there at the time. And the person who executed Murdoch's orders and suppressed the evidence was Stuart Kuttner, the managing editor of the News of the World. It was that simple. But as I say, I had a pass in Parliament, and I would encounter these people running around.
This is one of the pernicious aspects to all of this, is you've got parliamentary and police who may be investigating crimes being carried out by the Murdoch Empire. They all seem to be under surveillance in a fashion that if they get too close to maybe a prosecution or some sort, they'll be destroyed in the press.
Well, the key thing was the admission made by the Sun, which put the Sun in. You know, it said the Sun has committed criminal acts. And the question you're asking, and I can't answer, is why the Metropolitan Police have said, well, you know, yeah, we took a note of that. But it's more serious than that. In July last year, the Metropolitan Police sent out a press release saying they'd had a complaint from Mr. Brown. It wasn't Mr. Brown, it was Gordon Brown. It was the Right Honourable Gordon Brown, a senior member of the Privy Council and a former Prime Minister. And he complained about the destruction of evidence. And the Metropolitan Police have not made an investigation.
Well, these are all very, very serious crimes. Perversion of the course of justice, misconduct in public office on the side of the police. But, I mean, what we're saying here is, I mean, potentially these are up to life in prison, these sentences for these crimes. But you can't expect the police to investigate themselves, really, and put themselves in prison. I mean, it's like the government. When the government commits a crime, the government is not going to find itself guilty.
No, it's... But the full story is much simpler. The full story goes back to last July when Gordon Brown said, these people committed a criminal offence and they have destroyed evidence. And the Metropolitan Police said, yeah, we got the letter. And they have refused and failed to investigate. This is really serious. This is blackmail inside Parliament. This is a blackmail of members of Parliament, and it's perverting, you know, it's lying in court.
Well, some people might say, Kevin, this is the way things have always worked.
In relation to the Metropolitan Police and Murdoch, and Murdoch was the person who authorised the bribes, that's how it has always been. But everybody thought last year that it stopped when Gordon Brown made his complaint. Well, Gordon Brown has not been told that his complaint is not being investigated. I have, but Gordon Brown hasn't.
Oh, right. I mean, you and I were both... Can you just tell us what when you were at the Sunday Times?
Well, I had, obviously, a boss... When I shifted to the Insight team, I told him fairly casually that, you know, I was down in Parliament and I saw these people running around blackmailing people. And he joked. He said, do you want your P45 now or this afternoon?
So what years are we talking about, Kevin?
That was in 1988 and 89. Then... when I heard, when I left News International and Sunday Times, and I heard the Metropolitan Police were investigating, of course I phoned up. And I told two police officers what was going on, and they didn't even make notes. The Metropolitan Police have known since 2011 that blackmail was being conducted and lies were being, perjury was being committed in court, and they did nothing. But to bring you right up to date, in the last 3 or 4 days, the Metropolitan Police have informed me that they are not investigating anything. That's the biggest crime.
So that's Kevin Carhill there, speaking about organised crime at the Murdoch Empire. But I also asked Kevin, he volunteered the information about why he thought Murdoch actually closed the News of the World. He made the point, well, when the News of the World was closed, there was no announcement. And here, according to Kevin, is why there was no announcement.
Thatcher was a kind of early version of Trump. The law didn't count. All that counted was power and money. But go back to the Boris Johnson appointed the chair of the BBC. I can't remember, he's Sharp. And there was a big fuss about the £800,000 loan that Sharp arranged for Johnson. The rest of the story didn't emerge. Johnson offered Sharp a peerage to continue to attack the BBC and undermine it. And that was the deal. Johnson got in line, as Thatcher had before her with Mackenzie, and offered Sharp a peerage if he'd carry on attacking the BBC and subverting it from inside. I mean, this is serious stuff. But the refusal of the Metropolitan Police to investigate anything is another crime.
Mm. Well, it's perversion of the course of justice. You're quite right. I mean, that seems to be what's going on here. Very, very serious crimes at the top of the Metropolitan Police.
Tony, do you remember when Murdoch closed the News of the World? There was actually no statement from Murdoch. There were mumblings in the media that he had done it because he was so ashamed of what the News of the World had done. That wasn't what happened. Stuart Kuttner was deleting and suppressing all the emails, 30 million of them, and he told Murdoch he couldn't finish it, he couldn't do it. There were too many emails to suppress them all, because the emails were between the Whip's officers in Parliament, MI5, the Special Branch, possibly MI6 as well. So in 2011, the suppression man told Murdoch it couldn't be done, and Murdoch closed the paper to stop the investigation. That was the most massive perversion of the course of justice in modern British history. Murdoch closed the News of the World to prevent evidence reaching the Met. Not that getting evidence to the Met meant anything, because nothing happened.
So that's Kevin Carhill explaining that actually this was part of a criminal cover-up. To close the newspaper was also to close all the emails, and also to close their obligation to talk to the police or anything. So they just basically vanished it into thin air and destroyed all the emails. Well, a little bit similar to Keir Starmer destroying all the emails to do with the arrest and the transportation of Julian Assange to the United States, or potential, and the trips to America done by Keir Starmer in trying to make sure that the Americans got their way and Assange was jailed and targeted when Starmer was the head of the director of public prosecutions, the head of the Crown Prosecution Service. So that's the reason why, apparently. And that longer interview with Kevin will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. I thought also it'd be interesting to hear a bit more from Laurie Flynn. We heard from him last week. He's the ex-World in Action, Construction News. Fascinating guy. I think you'd agree if you heard that clip from him last week. And here he is talking, summing up, really, along with Stephen Dorrell, some of the ins and outs of the shenanigans of the security services and how they get involved with all this kind of thing. And big political stories, including the idea of if there's a campaign group, you infiltrate it, or you just break it up, you destroy it, you send people in to destroy it. Fascinating stuff from Laurie Flynn and Stephen Dorrell at this Media North thing, and it's introduced by Granville Williams.
There have been glimpses where we've seen, I don't think we're going to get many more of them, but where we've seen the broadcast media, in particular current affairs programmes. First Tuesday with Grant McKee pursued miscarriages of justice for the Guildford Four and the and similarly, I remember very much the issue in Birmingham, sorry, the Birmingham Six, the miscarriage of justice. And it was a Granada World in Action programme that first said the forensics is flawed and the Birmingham Six were beaten up. That's how they were treated. And so, Laurie, I mean, you described some negative experiences, but what about that experience with the Granada World in Action? Was it anything positive about it at all, apart from that example I've given?
Oh, it's hugely positive, but it was hugely positive because Granada was a unequivocally evidence-driven left-wing socialist intervention into the communications jungle. In a sense, it was the replacement for the Daily Herald and the News Chronicle. It was founded by a man and his brother, the Bernstein family, who were remarkably cultured, capable entrepreneurs, business people, but who were people who had a profound sense of the appalling crisis that so-called civilization was going through in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And out of the war, I mean, the first thing that Sidney Bernstein tried to do after the war with his friend Alfred Hitchcock was to produce a film about Keir Hardie, the founder of the Labour, of the Scottish Labour Party, and the person who enabled Labour to have some purchase on the appalling nature of capitalism at that time. I mean, you're talking about a culture that was deliberately destroyed, that was put to the sword by the kind of political legislation that was brought in, not only to destroy World in Action, but to destroy This Week, to destroy Roger Bolton, to take out Yorkshire TV, yeah, to take out Weekend World, to take out the Friday night programme that Thames put on. You're talking about a huge landslide of tyrannical proportions. Yes, there are many. Let's also just deal with the Guardian for a minute.
Okay,
the Guardian has more than one side to it. There are some wonderful, wonderful people work there. Not all of them work there anymore. But the undercover policing inquiry is something that we need to say is a very serious achievement. Quite what the outcome will be is another question, because it's being delayed and delayed partly by the illness and I think death of the original judge and his replacement by the latest guy, who's quite a lot safer from what I hear. But that inquiry would not have come about without two things. The campaigners, and it's a grave admission on my part that I didn't mention the women who stood up and campaigned about the way they had been wronged, raped, misused, and deliberately exploited by the Metropolitan Police. This is a huge scandal, and it to me, it is quite appalling that this inquiry is dribbling away into the sands and not dealing and bringing out into the open what really happened here. This is a truly shameful event that these women were sincere, dissident, campaigning people who were set upon by the high command. There's no doubt about this. This was not something that was improvised by rank-and-file officers. This was driven right from the top. And it is, in Italy, there's a thing called the cupboard of shame. Well, we've dealt with some of the components of of the British cupboard of shame. But high among them would be the treatment of these women and the treatment of two Irish solicitors who were murdered. Rosemary Nelson, Pat Finucane. These are huge, massive scandals of world-class importance, which are quietly being procrastinated, buried, parked away in buildings, in files. And until, I mean, the problem is the control of the commercial media is so powerful and the fear in the public sector of the BBC is so palpable that you are no longer getting any irritants from places like World in Action or Granada. Granada doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Its traditions were blown to the wind deliberately and deliberately destroyed.
Okay, Stephen, how close were we to GB75, a similar right-wing group, undertaking direct action in the UK? Also, does the actions of 68 onwards fit into a wider European strategy of tension to discredit left-wing groups? That's a long one.
The big conspiracy. I've often wondered about the events of 1968, whether they did fit into what's known as the strategy of tension, because it certainly seems like it, that there were elements of it, because I know for a fact that extreme right people and extreme right groups did take part in some of the events of 68 and were used by special branch, etc. The problem is as identified by Laurie, this country is so secret, we do not know. There are no files, no one's come forward. We just do not have the situation that was in Europe in the 1990s, where each country carried out a pretty extensive inquiry into their own stay-behind, Gladio, strategy of tension, etc. It's never taken place here, which indicates to me there is something that they are hiding. I'm writing a book about it at the moment, and I know something of it. But compared to other countries, we are in the dark. Some strange things did take place. GB75, I think you're referring to all the kind of intelligence, private armies, etc. They really didn't get off the ground. And in fact, I think most of them were designed purely as propaganda instruments. Yeah. They were never intended to do anything. They were intended to create a kind of fear, an idea that something might happen. And they were intended to provoke the government into doing something, or in the case of Wilson, bring it down. And that didn't happen. But it's very clear that there was a lot going on. And again, there's still things that we don't know about. One, to come back to something I think was Nigel was talking about, one of the things that the British are very good at, intelligence, is what's known as disruptive action, which is to divide groups. This is one of the key things they do abroad and they probably did here, which is to sow seeds of discontent within organizations, to give the illusion that they've been infiltrated, that key people are acting as agents. And they use the press a lot for this. You know, there's 25 officers in MI6. What do they do? Well, some of them are spreading disinformation in newspapers abroad. And they managed to destroy a couple of terrorist groups in the 1980s by planting information in the press with this idea that groups were fighting each other and the members had talked or were talking to the security services and all that kind of stuff. So they're perfectly capable of doing those kind of things.
Yes, that's Granville Williams, Laurie Flynn and Stephen Dorrell talking about security services and their interference with basic protest groups, you know, what you would think as a democratic protest group. No, we're not having that. It's not allowed. So after the break, we'll be back to have a look at Donald Trump and his inauguration.
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole wide world in his hands. He's got the whole
hands, he's got the whole. one whole year of genocide.
Real beheaded babies with no front pages. Israelis raping Palestinians in cages. US paid the wages. UK supplied intelligence. Elephant in room evidence. Levels of malevolence. Catastrophe developments. Starvation skeletons. Pestilence is prevalence. Trauma inheritance. Rampaging regiments. Degenerates wreck tenements. Weapon test experiments. Leave population to elements. Concentration collate in a camp where death awaits. A bomb descends and detonates. Disembowels evacerates. Poor souls torn shreds. Bodies no heads. Girls with no legs on their deathbeds. Heads without skulls. Hollowed out holes where there were souls. Dreams, goals. A father's last cuddle in a blood-soaked puddle. A ghostly grey child hangs plucked from the rubble. Planes bombing shrapnel. Embedded children, babies burned to headlines without who killed them. Six systems blame the victims for their decisions. Ignore the symptoms of cruel, callous coalition. Psychopathic politicians that they hate the mission. Incarcerate in prison, never pardoned or forgiven. 24/7, 365. One whole year of genocide. The world's most documented genocide in history. The most moral army in the world's military. Kills children, causes misery. Bombs buildings, deforms physically. Media lied deliberately. Propaganda trickery, death upon delivery. Her weapons supplied artillery from right to left to liberally, unequivocally. Cold cowards criminally, world stand by do minimally. This is not a mystery, take it back to history. Evil banality, left horror to prevail. Nothing is illegal if no one could curtail. When good people do nothing, humankind fail. Just a passive tale, blind masses. On a massive scale, last breath exhale. Decomposing personnel, death is all around the smell. Welcome to the gates of hell. Mow the grass, then expel. Escape comprehended, the Nakba never ended. As the bombs dropped, descended on the child undefended. A soldier smiles demented, self-defense presented. Victimhood invented, words pretend offended. Force of freedom makes you quiver. From the sea to the river, tidal wave, every killer, every sniper pulling trigger. Every child that you disfigure paints the world a bigger picture of a country getting sicker. Genocide, spread the virus, racist rats, right to rape riots, pious pirates. Existential crisis, there's no coming back from this. Collapse the state catalyst, your own antagonist. Psycho-sadomasochist, as Palestine persists. For the right to exist, the right to resist. Gets demonized, dismissed. 24/7, 365. One whole year of genocide. 1 year of genocide. 1 year of rain. We're normalizing violence, we're normalizing pain. We're organizing silence, making it mundane. One whole year of genocide, one whole year of rain.
One whole year of genocide.
So that's Laurie London. He's got the whole world in his hands from 1958. Warrior on the Edge of Time from Hawkwind in 1975. And 1 year of genocide by someone who calls himself Bobby, but it's BBOBBYY, and that's from last year. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Without Irish Labour activist Martin Summers, sadly missing, but he'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Ami Tony Gosling, bringing you, I suppose, what we do every week. What is it? It's a look at all the things that are missing from the mainstream press, I suppose, and also a proper deep coverage of the stories, because we're getting so much superficial stuff. So we'll start, rather than going straight into Trump, let's look at Axel Rudikubanu, who's admitted this week, pleaded guilty, so some sort of plea bargain, I assume, to murdering these three little girls in Southport. And the thing that shocks me about all this is the detail that the authorities had beforehand about all of his various crimes. He was bringing knives to school. He was threatening teachers, actually trying to attack people for years. And so I'll put a link to on our show page to an excellent article explaining what's now become revealed. As he's pleaded guilty in court, it can come out now rather than through the court process. The other angle to this, of course, is the thing that I've been campaigning, I suppose, on for a while, which is the Order of the Nine Angles. This is a satanic group which is largely online grooming people. Now, we know Shamima Begum was groomed online by Canadian intelligence. She was brought all the way over to Turkey and became an ISIS bride, along with her two 15-year-old school friends from Bethnal Green. So, you know, this is the same age group. They're being targeted. They're vulnerable. Seems obvious to me that what he's doing is just for notoriety. And this is one of the signatures of the Order of Nine Angles. But anyway, they didn't come up in this report. It seems obvious to me. I don't know why Order of Nine Angles are never mentioned in these reports. It's a satanic Nazi group which hasn't been banned by the Home Office. One would almost think that the Home Office are part of this satanic group. So here is a news report about a neo-Nazi, someone else, a Satanist, who was jailed for encouraging suicide online and possessing terror material. So it's obvious this grooming is going on.
Cameron Finnegan was a social recluse who thrived online in an international network promoting extremism and violence. His bedroom in rural Sussex, draped in satanic imagery, was from where he encouraged a young woman to take her own life. Police currently don't know what happened to her. He had planned to live stream it to a community with shared extremist ideology known as the 764.
The thing this girl was concerned about is the if she went through with it and I got caught.
Not about whether she was dead or not.
I don't think about stuff in that moment. It's just stupid I say without thinking.
The 19-year-old believed completing dark acts would help him gain notoriety in the group. Knives were found in his bedroom, along with the punch bag he practiced on. He talked of participating in a terror week. A homeless man living near his house was his target. Police also found that Finnegan was in possession of an 11-page terrorism document detailing how to commit mass casualties, including vehicle and knife attacks. His search history was immense, but radicalisation began in late 2023. Evidence seen by Sky News shows Finnegan was a prominent member of the 764 group. Whilst much has been removed, sinister material continues to be shared, including pressuring others to self-harm and making light of child abuse. Some members have even called for his release.
We particularly saw after COVID that there are a number of children, vulnerable adults, using that online space. And just the fact that 764 actively target vulnerable individuals, they threaten them, they extort them. You know, they're encouraging them, like Cameron Finnegan, to commit suicide, to post online acts of self-harm, as well as child abuse images.
Finnegan was arrested in March last year after pleading guilty to five charges, including encouraging suicide and possessing indecent images of children. He has now been sentenced.
Although I have some degree of optimism that your mental health will improve in a custodial setting, away from the dark recesses of the internet, public safety would not be fulfilled by imposing a determinate sentence.
To police, Finnegan describes 764 as a cult. He may have been jailed, but groups he operated in do still exist. Ash Naharanag, Sky News, at the Old Bailey.
The key word in all this is notoriety. That's what this guy was after, and of course it's what Rudikubanu, nobody seems to be taking that at all seriously. Notoriety, talking of which, we've got Donald Trump now, haven't we? He's now in charge, as he very much hoped, but I think we'll start not by his big speech about his inauguration, etc., but having a little listen Billy Graham's son introduced him. Both of the two priests, a priest and a vicar, I think it was a bishop, or maybe it's a bishop, a Catholic and a Protestant preacher, both did little speeches, and I'll put all that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk before Trump's inauguration speech, which I'll also put up. But let's have a listen now to a bit of a flavour, and they're both pro-Israel, funnily enough, even though Israel is raising hell in the Holy Land. So, as you can see, there's a little bit of orchestration going on here behind the scenes. Are these people really Christian, are following Christ's message, or are they people who are on some Zionist gravy train? Let's have a listen.
As President Donald J. Trump takes the oath of office once again, we come to say thank you, O Lord our God. Father, when Donald Trump's enemies thought he was down and out, you and you alone saved his life and raised him up with strength and power by your mighty hand. We pray for President Trump that you'll watch over, protect, guide, direct him. Give him your wisdom from your throne on high. We ask that you would bless him and that our nation would be blessed through him. We also ask that you would bless and protect Melania as First Lady. We thank you for the beauty, the warmth, and grace that she shows not only to this nation, but to the whole world. We thank you for Vice President-elect J.D. Vance and his wife Usha and their young family. May he be a strength to President Trump, to stand beside him, to hold up his arms like Aaron held up the arms of Moses in the midst of battle. The prophet Samuel reminded the people, it was you that brought them up from the land of Egypt. And he said, now stand still that I may reason with you before the Lord. So, Father, we take this moment to stand still, to remember the great things that you have done for this nation. Thank you for the protection, the bounty, the freedoms that we so enjoy.
So that's Billy Graham's son talking God. Obviously, in the background to all of this is this idea that Trump was amazingly, he somehow managed to survive the assassination attempt. This is all God's work. So this has sort of set him up to be this messianic figure, a bit worrying. So here is Donald Trump's actual speech itself. And here he is talking, this is inauguration. Here he is talking about armed forces and foreign wars. I'm not sure if it really is significant he didn't have his hand on the Bible. He was supposed to, but I don't know about those sorts of, I don't know if, how much, Jesus says, never swear an oath. Simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anything else comes from the devil. So, by swearing an oath, actually, you're going against the Sermon on the Mount, Donald Trump. There's no need to put your hand on the Bible. It's whether what you say is accurate, truthful, and honest or not that really matters. And you don't have to swear an oath to say that. So let's have a listen now to Trump himself giving his thoughts on foreign policy.
Our armed forces will be freed to focus on their sole mission, defeating America's enemies. Like in 2017, we will again build the strongest military the world has ever seen. We will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into. My proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker and unifier. That's what I want to be, a peacemaker and a unifier. I'm pleased to say that as of yesterday, one day before I assumed office, the hostages in the Middle East are coming back home to their families. America will reclaim its rightful place as the greatest, most powerful, most respected nation on earth, inspiring the awe and admiration of the entire world.
So that's an excerpt from Donald Trump's inauguration. Anyway, I went straight to the LaRouche Public Affairs Committee because we've got an interesting thing developing with a lefty, so-called lefty, they're not, are they, globalist Starmer, and we've got a nationalist Trump. Trump is in charge, surely, aren't they? This is what LaRouche looks at. They're very good, actually, LaRouche Public Affairs Committee, in comparing the Britain and America and seeing who's really in charge. They think the Brits are in charge, and I'm inclined to believe them sometimes. Anyway, so I thought I'd ask Harley Schlanger this week from LaRouche Public Affairs Committee. He's done an article as well about Trump this week. About competence, particularly, why have we got such incompetent leaders? This seems to be a bit of a problem, and also this dilemma of who's in charge, Britain or America.
What you have when you ask about the question of competence, they really believed, and this goes back to the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, but before Schwab there was Kissinger and these guys, they believe that the nation state is a bad thing. Because if you have parliaments or congresses that are responsible or depend on popular support, they'll do things that go against what the ruling class wants. And so what they try to do is have the elections and parliaments as sort of circuses, while the real power is in the hands of technocrats over and above governments. That's what the so-called Great Reset was about. This is what Schwab was talking about. This is what Mark Carney, the former head of the Bank of Canada, was committed to. This is what the U.S. Federal Reserve is about. Keep the power in the hands of the private banks and the insurance companies and the corporations, and have them have jurisdiction over and above elected representative government, and bring the technocrats in to make the decisions. The problem is that the technocrats are making decisions that are insane, like the idea of getting rid of fossil fuels, nuclear power, shutting off cheap oil and gas from Russia to Europe. That's provoking a collapse of the economies. And it's, in a sense, you hit it right on the head. This is the Roman Empire. These things always collapse because their chains of command and their supply chains depend on things that they have no control over. And eventually they lose that control. You go through a period of chaos and then something better, hopefully, will emerge. I think we're in a period of transition right now between the collapse of the unipolar order and the emergence of a new multipolar order. It's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be a simple thing. But there are many governments now that are breaking with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with France. Look, France has just been kicked out completely of French West Africa. And these are poor countries that are saying, we don't want you anymore. The neo-colonial era, which has gone on for 600 or so years, is over. And the problem is that the people who have been running it haven't come up with an alternative to control it other than war.
Well, there is another thing, and that's the population. Looking at their economic models, they seem to think that AI is going to be running everything, Harley, and the idea of even the consumer society driving the economy, that's going. So they don't need consumers. It's almost like they don't need the population. The population is surplus to requirements these days.
Well, this is the whole secret of eugenics and the idea of population reduction, which has a long history in Britain going back to Parson Malthus. The idea that from the establishment, all you need is enough people to be the servants and any excess population should die off. And Bertrand Russell, in commenting on this, said war has been ineffective at reducing population. But a good plague every generation or so would allow the elite to prosper. And that is the outlook of these so-called establishment elite, that that they're the ones who are necessary. They need a servant class to do the work, but they don't need a large population. And so we're seeing increasingly policies tearing apart the healthcare system, for example. The idea of lowering wages to the point where people can barely survive. Pandemic spread, these things, you know, are predictable. And this is part of the policy. And, you know, Kissinger, going back to him, he once said, history has never been made in the global South. And his policy to the global South was summed up in a 1975 classified document, which called for the Western powers to use food as a weapon to reduce populations in the poorer countries so that the poorer countries don't demand their share of their own resources. That's the modern imperial policy.
Well, that's the policy which may be fading away. But look, let's get back to the central point, which is London versus Washington.
Some people think that the Jews run the world, that the Zionists are the most powerful force. They were created by the British aristocracy. You know, there was not a movement among Eastern European Jews to move to Palestine. Most of the Eastern European Jews who were threatened in the 19th century with pogroms and other kinds of attacks wanted to go to the United States or Western Europe. It was only after World War II that they were rounded up and sent to Israel. And Israel has served as a kind of hammer against the other nations in Southwest Asia. And this was by design. The Balfour Declaration, even before that, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the secret agreement between Britain and France. So you look at this and you see, where's this power come from? Is it really Jewish money that's so powerful? Well, it's the Zionist movement has infiltrated and taken over many of the leading corporations. The corporate cartels are run by people who are Zionists.
Harley Schlanger there, and having Harley around is great. It's useful, very, very useful. I'll put the full version, we talked about lots of other things too, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the wisdom of the foreign policy, some of the deeper issues around, you know, the history of what's been going on between Britain and the United States. And as part of all of this sort of tension that's been winding up, what about nuclear weapons? Now, this is a story that's hardly got any reporting this week at all. Europe has been put on high alert, apparently, and I think this might even be an AI article. I'm very sorry if it is, but there was no reporting of this hardly. These brand new nuclear weapons, nuclear bombs, have been delivered to Europe this week. And no reporting on it at all. So they're getting ready for a World War III in Europe. And I guess this is a sort of parting thing of the Biden empire, is to make sure that the deep state and the Pentagon have got plenty of nukes in Europe. And we'll hear a bit more a bit later about why that might be.
The security landscape in Europe has shifted dramatically in recent years. These events have led to a renewed focus on deterrence and collective defence within NATO. Capabilities of the B61-12. Precision and flexibility. The B61-12 boasts several key features that distinguish it from its predecessors. Improved accuracy. The new tail kit transforms the B61-12 from a free-fall bomb into a guided weapon. This increased accuracy significantly enhances its effectiveness against hardened targets like underground bunkers or command centers. Variable yield. Unlike older B61 variants with fixed yields, the B61-12 offers selectable yield options. This allows military planners to tailor the explosive power of the weapon to the specific mission, providing greater flexibility and potentially minimizing unintended consequences. Interoperability. The B61-12 is designed to be compatible with a wide range of aircraft, including US fighters like the F-15E, F-16, F-35, and B-2 bomber, as well as NATO aircraft such as the Tornado and F-16. This interoperability strengthens NATO's nuclear sharing arrangements. Implications for Europe, NATO, and Russia. A new era of nuclear deterrence. The deployment of the B61-12 in Europe has far-reaching implications. Reinforcing deterrence. For NATO, the deployment serves as a powerful signal of commitment to collective defense and a reinforcement of its nuclear deterrence posture. It aims to dissuade potential aggression by demonstrating the alliance's willingness and capability to respond to threats, escalating tensions, Russia has consistently voiced strong opposition to the presence of US nuclear weapons in Europe, viewing it as a direct threat to its security. The deployment of the B-6112 is likely to further escalate tensions and could prompt retaliatory measures from Moscow, such as deploying its own advanced weapon systems closer to NATO borders, lowering the nuclear threshold. Some experts argue that the enhanced accuracy and variable yield of the B-61-12 could inadvertently lower the threshold for nuclear use in a conflict. The perception that these weapons are more usable could increase the risk of miscalculation or escalation in a crisis. Impact on arms control. The deployment also casts a shadow over future arms control efforts. With tensions between Russia and the West at a post-Cold War high, prospects for new arms control agreements are dim. The deployment of the B-61-12 further complicates the landscape and makes dialogue even more challenging. Conclusion: a complex calculation? The deployment of the B-61-12 in Europe is a complex issue with no easy answers. While proponents argue that it strengthens deterrence and enhances NATO's security, critics warn of the potential for increased tensions and a heightened risk of nuclear escalation. The modernization of nuclear arsenals is a continuous process, but it's crucial to recognize the potential consequences of such actions. In the current geopolitical climate, characterized by mistrust and heightened tensions, open communication and dialogue are more critical than ever to prevent miscalculations and avoid a dangerous escalation that could have devastating consequences for Europe and the world. Thank you for listening to Global Defense News and Analysis.
That's a news report from GDNA, all about these new nukes which have been delivered to Europe. Haven't heard much about that, have we? All over the place. It should be really being shouted from the rooftops, and it certainly should be the top of the news. A new generation of nuclear weapons are coming to Europe, but they don't really want us to know, do they? So when the nuclear war happens, they go, oh, sorry, well, we didn't know it was coming, and neither did you. Anyway, Mark Sloboda is one of the best. He worked on the American nukes for the US Army, I think it was. But anyway, he's now in Moscow State University teaching international relations there. So I thought it'd be interesting to hear what he makes of the Trump-Ukraine Starmer strategy. This was on RT this week, which is difficult to get here. You can get it on Rumble, but you can hear this little talk about Ukraine and Starmer. With the longer one is we've got Mark Sloboda, so I'll put that up on our show page later too. Here is, is Mark Sloboda.
Trump, one, doesn't like the Kiev regime's leadership, you know, either the previous one or this one. He regards them as his domestic political enemies in the United States because of the way they quite stupidly and heavy-handedly wade into U.S. domestic politics on the issue. And then the clumsy attempts to manipulate him afterwards were transparent, even, I think, to Trump. And he certainly thinks it's not in U.S.'s, shall we say, red line strategic interests. He thinks it's a waste of money. He also has nothing but contempt for the majority of Western political leaders in Europe who are the biggest, crusaders in this particular measure. And that brings up, you know, the obstacles to this. One of them has already been launched by one of Trump's political enemies, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Keir Starmer, who evidently sent political operatives to the United States to campaign effectively for Joe Biden. Really dumb move there. But he was just in Kiev and signing a largely rhetorical and substanceless 100-year commitment security guaranteed to Ukraine that really doesn't actually say much at all. He's attempting to, one, continue the Western process of, lifting his leg and urinating on Kiev as Western geopolitical territory. But it's also a direct shot at the Trump administration. You think you're going to pull out of this? I don't think so. This is definitely intended as an obstacle. You know, of course, a signal to Russia, but also a signal to the Trump administration. And these Western political leaders, they are committed to this conflict, and they are very upset. They were upset during the first Trump administration. They expressed joy at the return of the hegemon to form under Joe Biden. And they are furious at being put in the same position again. They believe in U.S.-led Western global hegemony more than the U.S. president does, and they're going to try to rope him back into the Ukraine conflict, whatever he may think about it or not.
So that's Mark Sloboda there speaking to the RT Crosstalk program. Peter Lavelle, I think, is that does it. And also on that program, too, is George Samuel. A pretty good panel. Pretty top, I would say. That's my kind of dream team to be commentating on what's going on. They're really good on Europe, particularly. So that's I'll put that up on our show page, the full version at thisweek.org.uk. But also, of course, with Trump coming in, we've got RFK Jr. And here he is reacting to Donald Trump's order to declassify the JFK in the RFK and Martin Luther King files. This will be interesting because we've been playing for many years on this program. I mean many years, probably a decade. Clips from this interview with James Files, which explains that what the CIA, James Attlee Phillips at the CIA, Johnny Roselli, Charles Nicoletti were commissioned by James Attlee Phillips at the CIA. They were hitmen from the Chicago Mafia to go down and kill Kennedy in 1963, and they missed. They were firing from behind, and James Files was an 82nd Airborne Korean War veteran. He blew the back of Kennedy's head off from the grassy knoll.
We went back to the vehicle. I took the briefcase out and turned my jacket inside out. I went back into the yard, and to the railroad yard there. I secured the briefcase, and then I hung out back there, and I walked down on the grassy knoll. I looked things over. Nobody paid any attention. People were gathering. And shortly before the motorcade came, I went back up there and started securing myself in a better position so I'd be able to reach the attaché case at that point, the briefcase. Excuse me. And I knew once that I opened the briefcase up and pulled the weapon out, nobody's going to be looking at me. The motorcade would be coming, making its first turn, and I wouldn't have to remove the fireball from the briefcase until approximately they made the turn on Elm Street there. And I would have plenty of time at that point. And at that point, when they started proceeding down Elm Street, shots started being fired from behind. And I assumed that it was Mr. Nicoletti, because he was the one who was in the building, and I knew that Johnny Roselli was there. And I remember the shots ringing out, and even though the president was being hit with the rounds, I was considering it a miss because I knew that we were going for a headshot on the president. And I had known he had been hit in the body, but I didn't know what part at that time. And I seen the body lurch, and I saw the body lurch again. I heard another shot that missed, and we were supposed to hit no one but Conley. I mean, no one but Mr. Kennedy. And I guess Governor Conley got hit with one of the rounds at that point. And I wasn't even sure of that because I was keeping Kennedy as best I could in the scope on the fireball. And when I got to the point where I thought it would be the last field of fire, I had zeroed in to the left side of the head there that I had, because if I waited any longer, then Jacqueline Kennedy would have been in the line of fire. And I'd been instructed for nothing to happen to her. And at that moment, I figured this is my last chance for a shot, and he still had not been hit in the head. So as I fired that round, Mr. Nicoletti and I had fired approximately at the same time as the hit started forward, then it went backward. And when I would have to say that his shell struck approximately 1/1000th of a second ahead of mine, maybe, that's what started pushing the head forward, which caused me to miss in the left eye, and I came in on the left side of the temple. And at that point through the scope, I witnessed everything, matter and skull being blown out to the back of the limousine, and everyone on television watching saw Jackie Kennedy crawl out there to get it. And I watched her hold on her hand to crawl back in the car, and I put the fireball back into the briefcase and closed it up, and I'd pull my jacket off, reverse my jacket, so I would have, instead of a plaid side out, I would have the gray like a dress jacket, more or less. And I put a cap on my head, and I had to walk away carrying a briefcase.
And he's been chatting about this, not that anyone seems to want to know. So I imagine that's what will be revealed if these files really are opened up, that it was the CIA and James Files was the hitman.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. reacting today to President Trump's order to declassify documents related to the JFK and Robert F. Kennedy assassinations. Kennedy is the son of the late Senator Robert F. Kennedy and a Trump cabinet nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services. He has said in the past that there is evidence that the CIA was involved in his uncle's death and spoke to NBC News as he left a meeting with senators ahead of his confirmation hearing next week.
President Trump.
You think that that's the right move to declassify this?
I think it's a great move because we need to have more transparency in our government, and he's keeping his promise to have the government tell the truth to the American people about everything.
So that would be interesting, won't it? Let's see what happens there as these files are revealed. Finally, let's hand over, because there's all sorts of Zionist implications to it as well, but we've had a bit about that already. Trump is Anglo-American tyranny, right? So that's what's happening. And he's dead now. God rest his soul. Manfred Petrich spoke to me back in 2016. We had a clip last week, actually, didn't we? Bilderberg exposed in Dresden. This is another one from that series. I was looking through them. Fascinating. And here he is with his little expression, the politicians have nothing to say. That was the origin of that. When I spoke to Manfred just after the Bilderberg conference in 2016, Manfred Petrich speaking to me from Abkhazia, from the Alice, Shaul and Rausch blog. He talks here about Anglo-American tyranny and explains it very, very well.
In the First World War, England and France had lost 1917. I mean, the Germans had won the war. They beat the Russians on the East Front, moved all the troops to the Western Front, and they beat the British and the French. What happened was that through the Balfour Declaration, it was promised that the Americans would get into the war, and that, of course, turned the table. And the same thing happened with the Second World War. Right, I mean, but that would be a huge long story if we go into the First and Second World War.
Well, it's also worth pointing out that a lot of money for Hitler came from Wall Street, for example.
Before, yeah. And don't forget that, for instance, the Americans knew perfectly well that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor because they were reading all their communication. And they definitely let it happen. They let it happen so that they could give themselves away as victims and then declare the war, because up to Pearl Harbor, the American public was totally against involvement in the Second World War. They were isolationists, and so they needed this Pearl Harbor thing to happen. And by the way, 9/11 was also declared by George W. Bush to be the second Pearl Harbor. You need these attacks against yourself to be able to do your wars that you want.
So what's the point of it all, Manfred?
The world domination, of course. I mean, the whole point of the American aggressiveness is world domination, and every country which does not bow down and follow the orders which come from America is declared an enemy, right? I mean, this applies to China, to Iran, to Russia, to any country that does not bow down to the imperialistic dictatorship of the elite, who does not accept a multipolar world. They want a unipolar world where they dominate everything.
Well, yes. You've just recently moved to Abkhazia on the Black Sea from Switzerland. Now, Switzerland is seen as a neutral safe haven. Two world wars have happened around Switzerland, and I just see the Swiss bankers as kind of sitting on top of their mountains with the binoculars watching the war going on and counting the money coming in. But you've moved to the Black Sea, which is almost like, potentially anyway, kind of ground zero in any kind of future conflict between NATO and Russia. So why have you gone from this kind of safe haven in Switzerland to somewhere which is potentially a bit of a hot potato?
Well, I'm sorry, I have to completely destroy your illusions. First of all, Switzerland is not a safe haven. Secondly, our politicians in Switzerland are exactly the same traitors as like in all the EU countries. They would sell Switzerland to Brussels in 5 minutes if they could. And that's why our head of parliament, the president of the Swiss parliament, was in Dresden at the Bilderberg meeting. I also talked to her for 2 hours after the meeting. That means, you see, for me, when the Bilderberg meeting in 2011 was in Switzerland, I realized by watching what was happening and organizing the protests there that we have lost the game. We have lost the game. And that the politicians have nothing to say. They have nothing to say. They're all controlled by the big, huge corporations. And we have the problem that they have all the power. They own the military, they own the media, they own the police, they own the judges, they own the all the powers that you need. And we on the other side, we own nothing. So we have lost. And also that there is this absolutely hysterical drive to make war with Russia. I mean, we see this in the last years, how they have been bashing Russia and Putin like hell. And they also moved all their troops and their weapons towards the Russian border. They have now installed this so-called anti-ballistic rocket system in Romania, which they're telling us are against rockets of Iran and North Korea, which is a laugh. Now, you said before that I moved into an area which could be a potential target. No. The potential target is Europe. Europe will be flattened in a future war. Not Russia or America. Europe will be flattened again. And I tell this to all my German friends. I tell them, do you realize that because of all the American military bases there, all the command centers in Germany, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, and all these bases, and also that you have atomic weapons stored in Germany, that you are a prime target for a war? That the first thing that will be hit is Germany? Because that's where all the Americans have their bases. And all wars come from German territory.
Well, hang on a minute, because you've just talked about CENTCOM and AFRICOM. What are they and where are they based? We don't hear about them in the news.
Well, that doesn't mean they don't exist. I mean, CENTCOM and AFRICOM, for instance, the center is in Stuttgart. That's the command center for all the military operations which are done in Africa and in the Middle East. It's all controlled from Stuttgart, the big military base there and command center there. The same applies to, for instance, Rammstein. From Rammstein, all the killer drones are controlled, which fly over Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and North Africa, wherever they fly around and kill people. They're all controlled from Rammstein, this huge Air Force base there. And Wiesbaden is the big European military central command. You see, there are over 70,000 American troops based in Germany. 70,000 American soldiers occupying Germany. That's the most occupying force in the whole of the world. Well, more than in Japan or more than in South Korea.
That's Manfred Petrich there. Anglo-American Tyranny, recorded in 2016, just after the Bilderberg Conference in Dresden, and at the time of the Brexit vote. So thank you very much, Manfred. Bless you. A lot of his material is still out there, here and there. Very, very good to see. So let's move on to look at AI now. Dominic Cummings. Let's go back a few weeks to before Christmas. Dominic Cummings did quite an interesting interview where he says AI is already in control. Dominic being, of course, the chief advisor to Boris Johnson.
You have to have people with technological expertise near the PM. But you can only do that if the PM clearly takes it seriously. because all of these people can make massive amounts of money and do all kinds of fascinating things, or in companies, or be in a place like this, which is very conducive and lovely for people to live in. No one wants to be, no one like that wants to be in a non-job around the PM. There's lots of officials who are happy being in non-jobs around the PM, but the technical, able technological people don't want to be in that thing. So you have to have a PM that actually wants to, takes it seriously, a PM that puts his own power and responsibility behind taking it seriously, and then has these people there. The second thing I would do is I would approach the AI problem slightly obliquely, and I would say, we've just had COVID. Across the Western world, it was a fiasco. We're going to create the actual entity that should exist to deal with future pandemics, because for sure, we are going to face future pandemics, and possibly pandemics in which AI plays a role, given that these models now, people are experimenting with these models in terms of creating bioweapons and other things. And this is like a live issue inside the National Security Council and other parts of similar sorts of entities in London. So I would say, let's build the actual super-duper pandemic entity that should exist, but is prevented from existing by current Whitehall. Such an entity inevitably will integrate AI expertise into it. And then you will have a set of people who are thinking about possibilities for death on a large scale, and war, and terrorism, and how Whitehall works, and how power decisions are made at the centre of power, and how AI models work for prediction and for helping all kinds of other capabilities. And you'd be training a whole set of people on a daily basis to figure out how does AI and power and death, how do we actually manage these things in a live setting? So every day these people will be waking up and looking at reports coming in from the Congo or whatever, saying the new clade of blah-de-blah is duh, and the model predicts blah, and da-da-da-blah, and what do we do about that? So you'd have this very, very iterative process. And it's the sort of thing where you could, it's so important, right, because you could literally save a billion people's lives. It's a great job for a set of people if it's taken seriously. So you could imagine the PM saying, okay, we're going to build something, but it's going to be outside all of the normal horror show. It's going to be outside Whitehall HR entirely, and outside Whitehall procurement, and outside all of the things that make high-performance entities illegal inside Whitehall. Here's its mission. It's going to be part of the PM's office. Dump. And if you created that, you would then have something which I think would be an enormous asset, and would be training people to think properly about all of these questions, and bringing together theoretical questions and very, very practical questions and engineering questions and organizational questions. That's my best solution so far to this problem.
But what about policy?
Policy comes from having people. So I think the most important thing, you know, if you look at the last few years, I'll give you an example of policy. The Online Harms Bill, a total fiasco. The Online Harms Bill is there to deal with a much, like a sort of almost infinitely simpler problem than the ones we've been dealing about today, but it's completely beyond Whitehall. To deal with that, they've created an Online Harms Bill, which is completely farcical in almost every way. So my point is, it's sort of pointless thinking about policy while you have Whitehall structured the way it is, because it's just programmed to go inevitably wrong. I don't want the current Whitehall to regulate or do anything with AI, because it's just absolutely, definitely programmed to completely cock it up. You have to think at a more fundamental level. The fundamental level is true expertise and actual high-performance organizations. If you create that, then you're in a position that you've got something that could actually generate good policy.
Dominic Cummings there suggesting that AI might already be in control, and he's talking about the problems that there are going to be from that. And what he's saying is the old civil service combined with AI is causing all these problems. And another thing that goes alongside this AI, of course, is the central bank digital currencies, the digitization of everything. And here's Catherine Austin Fitz recently talking about the dangers of these digital currencies. It's just trying to reemphasize this. It's a form of slavery, basically. You know, so we not only do we control your money, we also control what you're allowed to spend it on.
CBDC stands for Central Bank Digital Currency. It is a currency issued directly by the central banks. It can be done on a wholesale basis, which is to essentially allow the commercial banks to issue it on a retail basis and do the management of it on retail and then relate back to the central bank, which will be a wholesaler, or it can be done directly by the central bank doing directly a retail CBDC. The challenge with CBDC is it gives the central bankers complete control and the ability to program your money. What it does is it gives them the ability to say what you can use your money for, where you can use your money. It's called programmable money. Some people call it smart contracts. I call it very stupid contracts. But it gives you the ability to issue programmable money and do complete surveillance and control of where and how people use their money. Now, I say that CBDCs are quite dangerous, and they are. However, it's very important to understand that this kind of complete control comes about not through CBDCs, but having an all-digital monetary system. So what we want to stop is an all-digital monetary system, because it is possible to do the equivalent of CBDCs on a private basis. So I can use merchant codes with your bank account and your credit card. I can kick you off your online payment systems if I don't like what you're saying on social media. There are many different ways if we go to an all-digital financial system. We have digitized throughout our economy, so our homes are full of digitized equipment that can be identified and surveilled. Our cars are more and more electric. They can be stopped remotely. The thing to understand is if we go to an all-digital transaction system, financial transaction system, with a digital ID, so I can tell you're you and I'm me with great precision, then suddenly all those different digitized items and equipments and systems snap into one complete control grid. And the key to that snapping into the control grid is the digital ID and the all-digital monetary system. Now, let me tell you what that looks like, because we don't have a financial problem. We have a governance problem. If you do it in a system where a secret governance system that is non-transparent and outside of your control, if that gives them the power to basically turn on and shut off your transactions, you know, we're in a coup d'etat world. By creating an all-digital transaction system with a digitized economy and a digital ID, suddenly the central bankers now control fiscal policy. They can determine where you go, when you go. So let's go back to the pandemic. During the pandemic, if the lockdown said you can't go more than a mile from your home and you can only go that on Tuesday and Thursday, in an all-digitized economy with satellite flying overhead, they can literally track you. And if you don't do what they say, they can turn off your money. Now, what this means is you not only have a usurping of the people's representatives, but you have a usurping of the state powers. So under the Constitution, the powers not delegated to the federal government are the reserve to the states. But now the central bankers asserting line of fiscal policy, making the rules and enforcing them centrally, can literally control healthcare or other powers reserved to the states and by the ability to literally control your financial transactions. The way to make that transition is just say total control. You know, if you don't eat cricket flour and synthetic meat made in lab, you know, we'll turn off your money. Use cash, encourage the local businesses to use cash, encourage your local banks to support cash. You can always use cash, and you can use checks. Keep the cash and check systems going.
Catherine Austin Fitz there. Yeah, don't know. They don't just control what you're allowed to spend it on. They really control whether you starve or not, don't they? Whether you're evicted or not. All this kind of thing is controllable through money. And this is we talked last week about the British version of a lot of these kind of AI companies, tech companies who are startups which are growing in Britain, massive amounts of money going into this. And over in the United States, there's this guy, Larry Ellison. So here he is talking. He's the chief executive of Oracle. Here he is. And he's been very, very close to Trump, actually. Actually standing next to Trump at an announcement this week. But here he is talking about total information awareness and how he thinks that this total information awareness, which is mass surveillance, will keep not only keep the police in line, but also the population doing what they're told.
The police will be on their best behavior because we're constantly recording, watching and recording everything that's going on. Citizens will be on their best behavior because we're constantly recording and reporting everything that's going on. And it's unimpeachable. The cars have camera, cameras on them. We have a squad car here someplace. But those kind of applications using AI, we can use AI, and we're using AI to monitor the video. So if that altercation had occurred, that occurred in Memphis, the chief of police would be immediately notified. It's not people that are looking at those cameras. It's AI that's looking at the cameras. No, no, no. You can't do this. It would be like a shooting. That's going to be immediately, that's going to be an event that's immediately, an alarm's going to go off. It's going to be, we're going to have supervision. In other words, every police officer is going to be supervised at all times. And the supervision will, and if there's a problem, AI will report the problem and report it to the appropriate person, whether it's the sheriff or the chief or whomever we need to take control of the situation. We have, same thing, we have drones. We just, if there's something going on in a shopping center, and I'll stop, a drone goes out there, get there way faster than a police car. There's no reason for, by the way, high-speed chases. You shouldn't have high-speed chases between cars. You just have a drone follow the car. I mean, it's very, very simple. And the new generation of autonomous drones.
That was Larry Ellison there, but let's hear him at the Trump event this week. The day after, I think, that Trump was inaugurated, maybe Tuesday, possibly Wednesday, Trump appeared flanked by Larry Ellison, Sam Altman, and somebody else, Masayoshi Son, announcing something called Project Stargate. But let's have a listen to what they had to say about the way AI is going to be used in the United States under Trump.
This is the, as you said yesterday, this is the beginning of golden age of America. This is one great example, I think, right? We wouldn't have decided to do this.
I think so.
This is the beginning of golden age. We wouldn't have decided unless you won. And yesterday, we agreed, we signed to make this happen.
Great.
Because of this day. So we would make this happen. We would immediately start deploying $100 billion with the goal of making $500 billion within next 4 years, within your term, right? Because of your success. So we are very, very excited to do this. And our partners, of course, SoftBank, OpenAI, Oracle, and additionally, investing partner with MGX. On top of that, we have the technology partner, NVIDIA. And of course, Microsoft has been very, very supportive to Sam and continue to support all our success. This is not just for business. As Larry said, this will help people's life. This will help solving many, many issues, difficult things that otherwise we could not have solved with the power of AI. I think AGI is coming very, very soon. And after that, that's not the goal. After that, artificial super intelligence will come to solve the issues that mankind would never, ever have thought that we could solve. Well, this is the beginning of our golden age. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Fantastic.
Sam. I don't have too much to add, but I did want to say I'm thrilled we get to do this in the United States of America. I think this will be the most important project of this era. And as Masa said, for AGI to get built here, to create hundreds of thousands of jobs, to create a new industry centered here, we wouldn't be able to do this without you, Mr. President. And I'm thrilled that we get to. I think it'll be an exciting project. I think we'll be able to do all of the wonderful things that these guys talked about. But the fact that we get to do this in the United States is, I think, wonderful. So thank you very much.
Could you just say one word?
These guys can maybe share more about some of the work they're doing there. I think they'll jointly be some of the leaders about driving progress here. But I believe that as this technology progresses, we will see diseases get cured at an unprecedented rate. We will be amazed at how quickly we're curing this cancer and that one and heart disease, and what this will do for the ability of to deliver very high quality healthcare, the costs, but really to cure the diseases at a rapid, rapid rate, I think will be among the most important things this technology does.
That's Larry Ellison and Sam Altman there, Trump introducing them, saying, look, are these great guys? Well, are they great? Well, what about in the UK? The science and technology minister here is Peter Kyle, and he was spoken to on Five Live this week, talking here about something called Humphrey. This is a reference back to Yes Minister series and Yes Prime Minister series, where you've got these civil servants sort of whispering in your ear the whole time. But this is amazing and quite disturbing that this guy's trying to sell this stuff like a kind of used car salesman, AI digital ID, and saying just how much more efficient and cheaper and quicker AI is than employing people. I mean, I suppose he's talking about sacking half the civil service, but maybe that's, I don't think it's a good thing. Most of these civil servants are brilliant, but they are quite obviously trying, and it's a throwback, isn't it, to what Dominic Cummings was saying about AI already running things. You do wonder, are ministerial speeches written by AI? Is policy being written by AI? There's no way to flag up if something's been AI written or not. Of course, there should be. This is what, because the government simply are not regulating this at all. So let's have a listen to this used car salesman calling himself a science and technology minister, Peter Kyle, talking to Matt Chorley on Five Live this week.
Tell me then about the AI tool being used in government by officials, Humphrey, named after Sir Humphrey Appleby from Yes Minister, who spent his entire time using a word salad to disguise what was really going on.
Yes, well, you've cunningly, because you are so embedded into the Whitehall life, found out the internal nickname that we've given to a suite of different productivity tools. We, as a digital centre of government in the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology, are devising, programming, engineering and deploying AI products and services in a safe and fully tested way to drive efficiencies within government. It's not one product that's called Humphrey, there's a series of them. And if I give you one example, there's a product called Consult. And Consult uses, it's able to analyze all of the legislation going back hundreds of years, all of the regulatory landscapes and rules that regulators have. And when ministers want to get to understand, to make a change in the law or a change in regulations, or even just make an announcement, Consult can look at all of this information and within minutes do what it takes weeks for a civil servant to do, because just imagine the amount of time. So it can deliver it 1,000 times faster than a human being can, and it can do so 400 times more cheaply than a human can. So we're talking about something that currently takes, you could do in 52 hours, that currently with human beings would take 6 years to do. That's the scale of ambition we have as a government. And that is the kind of product that it comes under the Humphrey umbrella that we're using internally.
Is there a risk then that all you need to do is put an AI voice on the end of that and we can do away with ministers?
Well, wouldn't that be wonderful? And I'll be you can't see me at the moment, Matt, so you don't even know if it is me you're talking to.
No, that is true. It's a very good box.
I guess it drives some kind of suspicion.
I mean, I have done interviews in the past with politicians, but I have been suspicious that I'm getting the same answer regardless of the question. But I feel like we've covered a lot of ground with you today. So, Peter Kyle, really good to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Matt.
That's Science and Technology Minister under Starmer, Peter Kyle, speaking about AI this week. And Humphrey, rather worrying. It's shocking to think that these people are speaking like that, in my mind. But Okay, so what is AI? We're going to get into that finally. Transhumanism, what is it all about? And I was amazed to find this week, David Livingstone, who's on this program, he wrote a book called Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And there are two AIs actually discussing his book. The idea is that they feed the book into his these artificial intelligences, and the two then start chatting to each other about it. So let's have a listen to an excerpt from these two artificial intelligences discussing David Livingstone's book, The Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, and the Occult Origins of Transhumanism.
It does seem like a leap from ancient mystics to robots and AI, but yeah. Hermeticism, for instance, it's this tradition that delves into kind of hidden knowledge and the interconnectedness of all things.
Okay.
And it really emphasizes this potential for humans to achieve a higher state of being, even a kind of divinity. Mm-hmm. And that's where the link to transhumanism starts to kind of emerge, you know.
So you're saying both Hermeticism and transhumanism share this ambition for transcendence.
Exactly. They both explore this idea of pushing beyond our perceived limitations.
Okay.
And in fact, Livingstone even highlights this quote from the Asclepius, which is an ancient Hermetic text. That really captures this connection. He quotes the text as saying, "Our ancestors discovered the art of creating gods."
Wow. That's a powerful statement.
It is.
It really makes you think about, you know, the implications of humans striving for godlike powers.
Yeah.
Especially in the age of AI.
Yeah. And that's exactly the point that Livingstone drives home.
Yeah.
He suggests that these mystical traditions, you know, while fascinating, they also carry a cautionary message.
Okay.
You know, for example, they often venerate figures like Lucifer, who in some interpretations represents this rebellion against authority and the pursuit of forbidden knowledge.
So you're saying that transhumanism could be leading us down a potentially dangerous path?
Well, Livingstone certainly raises that question. He argues that in our quest to transcend human limitations, we might be overlooking the potential consequences.
Yeah.
It's like we're so focused on unlocking the potential of AI and other technologies that we might be forgetting the lessons embedded in these ancient stories.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely giving me something to think about. It seems like this pursuit of human enhancement has a history of taking some dark turns.
Absolutely. And Livingstone dives into this as well, connecting these mystical aspirations to movements like social Darwinism and eugenics.
Okay.
Where the idea of improving humanity was used to justify some truly horrific acts.
Yeah, you're talking about the forced sterilization programs and the whole concept of racial superiority that fueled the Nazi regime.
Right. And what's chilling is how Livingstone draws parallels between these dangerous ideologies and the transhumanist desire for enhancement.
Okay.
You know, it makes us question who gets to decide what constitutes better when it comes to human beings.
Right.
Especially when AI starts playing a role in those decisions.
That's a disturbing thought. It's almost as if history is repeating itself.
Right.
But this time, with even more powerful tools at our disposal.
Yeah, Livingstone argues that we can't ignore these historical parallels. He even brings up Nietzsche's concept of the Übermensch.
The Übermensch or Superman?
Yeah.
The idea of individuals achieving their full potential.
Right.
But it's a concept that's open to interpretation.
Yeah, precisely. And Nietzsche himself ended up suffering a mental breakdown, possibly from syphilis.
Right.
And this serves as a cautionary tale about the dangers of pushing human boundaries too far, both physically and mentally.
It seems like every step towards transcendence carries some hidden risk. It's almost like we're walking a tightrope between progress and potential disaster.
And Livingstone's book doesn't shy away from exploring that tightrope walk. In fact, he takes us down a path filled with secret societies and their possible influence on transhumanist ideas.
Wait, secret societies?
Yeah.
You're talking about groups like the Freemasons and the Illuminati?
Yes, but he also delves into the Skull and Bones, that infamous secret society at Yale, with its ties to powerful families like the Bushes and the Rockefellers.
Wow, the plot thickens.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that these organizations have some hidden agenda when it comes to transhumanism?
Well, Livingstone doesn't explicitly state that, but he certainly raises the question.
Okay.
You know, he leaves us pondering the potential influence these groups might have on our technological future.
Right.
Especially with the rapid advancements in AI.
Okay, this is getting a bit spooky, but I'm completely hooked.
Yeah.
It's like we're uncovering this hidden history that's been playing out right under our noses.
And Livingston takes this exploration even further, delving into the murky world of mind control experiments.
Oh, yeah.
And the CIA's MKUltra program.
Right.
Which experimented with LSD.
So we've gone from ancient mystics to secret societies to mind control. Where does this deep dive take us next?
Well, Livingston shows us how the development of cybernetics,
okay,
which focuses on communication and control systems in both living organisms and machines, played a key role in blurring the lines between humans and machines.
Ah, so cybernetics is kind of the bridge between those early experiments and the technology that's shaping the transhumanist movement today.
You got it. And it's through this lens that we can begin to understand the concept of the global brain.
Okay.
Which suggests that the internet is connecting us all into a kind of collective consciousness.
So that's the Deep Dive podcast. Two AIs discussing David's book. Well, I had to, of course, get hold of David and ask him about this. This was Notebook LM, this program. Two AIs discussing his book on transhumanism and the occult. How did they get on, David?
There's a program. It's called, I can't remember what it's called. It's called Notebook something. I think it's created because somebody reached out to me a few months ago already to let me know about it. And he asked me if I didn't mind if he plugged in some of my content into it to see what would it produce. So I think it's a program created by Google.
Yeah, it's called Notebook LM. L for Lima, M for Mother.
Right. So you upload a file, and it's almost instantaneous too. It's amazing. So it creates a podcast. You can put in some prompts so that you can sort of help shape it. So that was the interesting exercise that was interesting for me because first of all, like the first attempts, I was blown away. I couldn't believe. First of all, it's amazing how it's instantaneous, and I couldn't believe how well it managed to pick the various elements of importance in what I was writing, and even recognizing some of the conclusions to be able to construct a fairly meaningful conversation, fairly meaningful. So, but the challenge was is that it kept trying to whitewash things. It kept trying to like come back to like this paradigm that I talked about. It kept trying. It would say things like, so this in particular, what he tried to do was my chapter on Babylon, which talked about the Magi and Mithraism and things like that. And it kept trying to turn things around of like, well, I guess these ancient magi were kind of like early explorers of the mind. And they were just trying to expand their knowledge. And they were, it wasn't able to see anything nefarious. Right. That's the fundamental paradigm that we're living in. You can't, your conspiracies don't exist. That's the premise that we are expected to operate on. It's the accident theory, as they call it.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying that these AIs weren't really able to see the subtext or irony at all. Everything is just line of literal. I think it's the one of the ways that the Brits kind of think of the Americans, actually, a lot of the time as being very literal and not seeing that irony or whatever.
That's funny. Yeah, it's pretty much like that. So we tried a couple of prompts to get it to see if it could, to ask it to look at more critically, but it couldn't. This one that was posted was a little bit better. But in the end, you can see by it doesn't really construct a very intelligent discussion. It picks a couple of relevant points. It does sort of gather some conclusions, and it sort of constructs something that approximates a human conversation. But it doesn't really properly communicate what the content of the article was. It would give you some hints because it did pull some elements from it, but it doesn't bring across its significance. And that's ultimately the short back of AI, right? That this is really what it comes down to, that it's artificial intelligence, and it's going to be an astoundingly powerful, useful, transformative tool. But we always have to understand the limitation that it imitates human intelligence.
Canadian writer David Livingston there talking to me about Notebook LM, doing the review of his book. So something missing. It must be very eerie having computers reviewing your book for you. I mean, book reviews are notoriously, like theatre reviewers, dodgy sometimes. But anyway, so here's a long version with David I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here he is talking about, I think, a bit deeper about what AI is really all about. The Golem, a kind of hidden agenda for centuries now coming out, the idea being to create life so that those who wield this power can become God.
We're finding a lot of journalists being sacked, AI taking over this role with no actual thought about whether that's the right thing, and certainly no tag but the side saying, by the way, this was written by a computer, not a human being.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of aspects there, right? There's the way that the rest of the society is digesting it, and then there's the reason why it's come about in the first place. So AI is no minor accident. It's not just like somebody's weekend project. This is the goal. This is the project of modern times. And I'm not sure how far you can go back. This is why it's funny, because Google recently published an article to indicating that AI can be traced back to the Golem. The Golem is a very old Kabbalistic legend. It was talked about by the Ashkenazi Hasidim. And the Ashkenazi Hasidim is a group of Kabbalistic rabbis that flourished in started maybe the year 900 or so, to 900 to about 1100 in Germany. And that is really where there's a whole break there, which is really a bigger story, right, about the break between sort of traditional Judaism and sort of rational Judaism and a more mystical branch of Judaism. Maimonides would be the one that represented the more traditional branch. And then so you get this sort of conflict that begins, and it begins with the Ashkenazi Hasidim, and it developed, and that's where you get the modern mystical tradition. It begins small there, but it grows in strength because they have links with the people, the mystical rabbis in southern France, and that's where you get the birth of the Kabbalah. So one important Kabbalist is Rabbi Lo of Prague. I think he lived in the 1500s. He was famous for apparently producing a Golem. So he was called, he's a Baal Shem, which means basically he's not called that, but it means he's a mission. A magician. He had power of what's called the names of power, which basically means that he knew the magical words to perform operations. So he used his knowledge of names of power which he pronounced over some kind of like mixture that he put together, and to produce this living creature, and the Golem. It's a Golem basically he used to protect the Jewish people. So that's why if you leap forward to Norbert Wiener, who is one of the founders of cybernetics, you have two of them, there's Norbert Wiener and John von Neumann. John von Neumann is the one who coined the term singularity, which is the basis of the transhumanist movement. And so Norbert Wiener wrote a book called God and Golem, Inc. And he explains that what makes God God is the ability to create life. So human beings will become God when they gain the ability to create life. So the creation of artificial intelligence, this is a book written back, like I think published in early 1960s, just to get some context about, you know, the significance of this. So he was already saying back then that the creation of artificial intelligence is what is going to make humans God. So, if you come back to the whole idea of Zionism, Zionism is a Kabbalistic cult, and their goal is to bring about a Gnostic interpretation, their Gnostic interpretation of the Book of Revelation. And so the creation of artificial intelligence, it's, you know, the settling of Jews in Israel is only one part of the plot. It's an essential one, but almost a larger one is the creation of artificial intelligence, which is supposed to serve. I'm not sure exactly what they've got planned for it. And you can read through the lines of what some of the transhumanists have said, but it's a central goal. So it's because the goal is to create this, you know, again, this is a story that goes back to many decades. There was already H.G. Wells, right, who's a known sort of globalist. If that's, I don't like, you know, not maybe not the best word for it, but that's.
Well, he was a Fabian as well. Yeah.
So he already talked about the global brain and creating a global library. This plan for a global brain and eventually artificial intelligence. So basically the plan to create artificial intelligence goes all the way back to the 40s, right? It goes back to Turing. So their goal is to create this AI, which will have access to, will be like a god. So it'll be omniscient. So it will have access to every aspect of human activity and the accumulation of human knowledge.
It sounds a bit like the U.S. military total information awareness.
Well, it's not an accident. That's why if you look at the logo of the the total information TIA program, which is a DARPA program. The DARPA is the department that created the internet in the first place. So the logo, this in fact is Annie Jacobson wrote a book about this, and she believes that one of the reasons why the program got so much flack is because of their logo. Their logo is an all-seeing is the pyramid with the all-seeing eye that's known from the American dollar bill, which is casting its vision on a globe. If you understand what I'm describing. So it's exactly they're communicating openly exactly what they're saying. So that the all-seeing eye, AI is to be an all-seeing eye, the Masonic all-seeing eye. So AI is to be an artificially created god that will basically give there's a number of ways. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what they have in mind, but there's a number of ways to look at that, right? It's like they've created a god, so that's how they become gods. They created life, and so, yeah, it's if you get where I'm going.
David Livingston there, again, AI on the Golem, a hidden agenda for centuries to create life so that those that wield this technology can become God. It's a bit of a strange dream, isn't it? I'm not sure that the MPs have been told, or hardly anybody's been told. Luckily, you have, I have. This is what they're up to, folks. Finally, I did promise you to look at the EU corruption, lies and confusion being ultimately satanic. That's what he says. And this is Christopher Story talking about the European Union.
Now, the prong against Britain, the main weapon against Britain, is the European Union collective. And the weapon against the United States is the penetration of the CIA and its affiliates with the German Himmler scientists and intelligence officers who were brought over after the denazification program was scrapped in 1946. And if you look up Operation Paperclip, that was the first major transfer of Nazis into the United States. So about 700 families went on under Operation Paperclip, but it went on and on and on right the way to the beginning of the 50s. So what happened was that the US intelligence power was taken over to some extent, or to a considerable extent, by a German Nazi fifth column who have been running the show ever since. Now, Kissinger is, I believe, the key to this, and he was instrumental in persuading President Ford to dismiss William Colby as DCI, the Director of Intelligence, in favor of George H.W. Bush. Now, George Bush is the representative in the United States of Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst, which is the German black agency based, believe it or not, in Dachau. And we call it DVD. I exposed DVD. It's nothing to be proud about because we've known about it for years. But I publicized it, and I know for a fact that certain intelligence officers from DVD have actually congratulated elements of MI6 on this exposure, because they think I'm MI6, which is, of course, complete rubbish. Anyway, the point is this, that the German operation, the operation against the United States has been run by DVD in Dachau, behind the scenes, and the same applies to the operation against the United Kingdom. Now, the DVD is self-financing, like the CIA, through fraudulent finance, and it advises the German Chancellor about its activities, but the German Chancellor can't tell it what to do, quote unquote. The DVD is running our lives and is the enemy within the enemy. Okay? Now, given that the German geopolitical center set out the program, how do we know that this is the case? We know it from a document called which has been called the Madrid Circular Letter, which was intercepted in about, I think it was 1951, by the Allies. This was a document being sent to the other Nazi centers in Buenos Aires, Cairo, Tehran, I think, and various other places, Tokyo, from Madrid by the German geopolitical center. And this document contains the following slogan: Für uns ist der Krieg niemals vorbei. For us, the war never ended. Now, one of my correspondents, Jack Christella, who is of British, he's British, but he's of German Jewish extraction, emailed me a very, very intelligent analysis and said that he thought that what they really meant was Für uns ist der Krieg nimmer vorbei. For us, the war never ended. I think that's true. I think that's correct. I think that's what they actually mean. In other words, they are Trotskyites. They are Mao Tse-Tung, perpetual war advocates. Now, so we have the problem that we're dealing actually not just, I mean, I've called the European Union our enemy, European Union collective, but within the collective is, of course, Germany. And that's the problem. Now, if I had time, I would have told you what I wanted to tell you, which is I wanted to proceed what I was going to say with a little scripture lesson. But I'll skip most of it, and I'll just read verse 1 of Psalm 127. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. That's the point. Where is the Lord to be seen in this structure? It is totally a-spiritual. It has no spiritual content at all. Excuse me? I'm a father of four daughters. We know that it's not just a question of our physical existence. We have a spirit as well. This entity is not connected at all to our spiritual existence because it is of Satan. And I'm absolutely clear about that. There is no question. Psalm 53, verse 1, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Now, the point here is, who is the author of lies and confusion? What is the European Union collective but confusion? The successive treaties, which are run every 3 or 4 years, are just updated versions. But if you look at them very carefully, and I know this because I worked with Bill Cash in 1992 against the Maastricht Treaty, at the beginning, you know, sort of paragraph 48, little 1, subsection C, you'll see one statement. And then way down 40 pages later, you've got that contradicted. That is the Soviet technique. That was exactly what happened under the Soviet Constitution. Rights are given, rights are taken away, and so on and so forth. It's the same. And there is an absolute parallel, because if you walk into the European Parliament, which I had privilege to do because I had a friend who is no longer an MEP, but I was there several times. If you walk in there, you can see you are walking into the Soviet, the Supreme Soviet. It's the same design. All they have to do is to remove the blue stars, or the yellow stars on the blue background, and substitute the hammer and sickle. Now, On the corruption point, you will be aware that the accounts of the European Commission have been specifically disapproved by the EU's own Court of Auditors for the past 14 years running. Okay? So this means that the last time that the European Commission had accounts which could be relied upon, quote unquote, was 15 years ago. Now, I've been running my own private company since 1963. If I produce false accounts, excuse me, I think something very serious happens to me. I'll probably get debarred and I may go to jail. These people have been producing false accounts for the last 14 years and no one is paying any attention. I want to draw your attention to the following reality. In order to correct this matter, they have to go back 15 years and they have to look at every single transaction that took place 14 years ago. They have to identify the fraud or anything that was irregular. They have to have that corrected, however that can be done. They have to have the perpetrators reported to law enforcement, and the law enforcement has to proceed with the appropriate measures. That has to happen 14 years ago. Then when they've corrected the 14th year, they go to the 13th year, and so on and so forth, right the way up to the present. Is that going to happen? No way, Jose. It's never going to happen. Okay? That's obvious. Therefore, the European Commission is a criminal enterprise. Now, I have a new Irish friend who's absolutely delightful, called Richard Sharp, with an E. He comes through from Ireland periodically on the way to the continent because he has to drive. And he does odd jobs for me in Europe. It's very, very convenient. And about 2 months ago, he said, I'll go to the Court of Auditors and I'll look them up. So he literally did a cold call to the Court of Auditors, which is the EU's so-called auditing entity, in Luxembourg. And he got to see a Mr. Giza Novacs, N-O-V-A-C-S. And Mr. Giza Novacs specifically confirmed, and by the way, I'm mentioning his name so that you know I didn't make this up, okay? You can ring him up and he'll have to say, you'll have to confirm that what I've just said is accurate. He confirmed that, yes, the European Commission's accounts have not been approved for the past 14 years. The European Commission is a criminal enterprise. Let me introduce my friend who was set up, by the way, Ashley Moat, MEP, who is a close personal friend and is an absolutely delightful man. He stepped down as MEP for South East England in June. And virtually the last thing he did was to go to see the Serious Fraud Office. Now, in 2005, he had previously been to see the Serious... I think it was maybe in 2006. He'd previously been to see the Serious Fraud Office with two large files, copies of which I hold. These files contain detailed allegations of criminal fraud committed by at least one enterprise, and I think there are several, which are registered in England and Wales, which did or do business with the European Commission.
Christopher Story then in a talk that he did back in October 2009. He's not with us anymore, but his words are fascinating. United States of Europe, really, we could call it, couldn't we? Anyway, finally this week, I did promise some looks at these films. This week, it's The Devil Rides Out, one of my favourite, probably the great occult novel and film of the 20th century. Written by Dennis Wheatley, who worked in World War II. He really did know some of the dark arts that were employed, and he realised that there was this occultic connection to the Nazis too. So let's have a listen. I mean, he's fascinating. He's talking about how these cults operate, and if you hear Wheatley speak, he explains that he did go and take Aleister Crowley, the famous Satanist, out for dinner to get plot lines for his stories. But what a film this is, from 1968.
My baby.
She does not hear you. She's in a state of deep hypnosis.
In the name of God, you dare not.
Scarcely in the name of God, Monsieur le Duc.
What's he going to do with her? Uncle.
Take me instead, MacArthur.
You, Monsieur le Duc? Your soul in preference to that of an unstained child.
What are you talking about? He isn't going to...
Yes. The transference of souls. That of your child for that of Tanith.
No!
Now, if our two remaining guests will permit, we may proceed. Almighty and all-powerful Set, Father of darkness, King of death, I pledge this knife to thee to do thy work and be thy servant.
Those are words you said before. Say them again.
And the blood of this child shall be...
I cannot. You must. My baby is going to die if you don't. You must speak those words again.
The bride of chaos.
The bride of chaos.
The rider upon the beast.
The rider upon the beast.
With this knife do I draw out the blood which is thy life.
Only they who love without desire shall have power granted them in the darkest hour. Peggy, get up. Repeat after me the words of the Suzama ritual. Uriel Seraphim.
Uriel Seraphim.
Io potesta.
Io potesta.
Zati Zata.
Zati Zata.
Galatim Galata.
Galatim Galata.
It's over?
Yes, Simon. It's all over.
Wasn't...
Come in, my friends.
He's all right. Tanith!
Time itself has been reversed for us. Tanith's death, Peggy's abduction, the ride to Chilbury, the ritual in the cellar, all these things happened. But now, they have not happened. We are back. We are all safe again.
And is MacArthur also safe?
You will also remember, Simon, what I said to you about the angel of death once being summoned.
Cannot return empty-handed.
Exactly. Tanith has been restored to us. But the age-old law demands a life for a life, a soul for a soul. And there is only one man in all this world who can replace her life, her soul. The man who invoked the angel of death. MacArthur is dead.
Thank God.
Yes, Simon. He is the one we must thank.
That's a clip from The Devil Rides Out, a film written by Dennis Wheatley, or on a book, based on a book written by Dennis Wheatley, made by Hammer in 1968, one of the all-time great occult films. And it's not really scary so much as it's explaining to you how these groups operate. And, you know, I suppose really looking at what they, you know, how you can combat them and how they con people. Anyway, that's it. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guests. We've got Kevin Carhill, haven't we? We've also got Harley Schlanger, as well as Ben Abrahamson and David Livingston there, and Tony Greenstein. So that's all for this week. You can download the MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel and via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes podcasts, full-length interviews and story links. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and I've got some bad news. I'm afraid RadioQUK.com looks like we'll be closing next Friday, so if you're listening on there now, the next Friday may be the last show on RadioQUK.com. All the best to James for trying to keep that going, and I hope it comes back in some form or other. Anyway, have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. God bless. And don't let the synagogue of satanic banksters get you down.
They've got the whole world in their house. They've got the whole wide world in their house. They've got the whole world in their house to see the new conservatory. They go 10-pin bowling after work. They go 10-pin bowling after work. They go 10-pin bowling after work. And they're getting married on a Caribbean beach. They've got a German shepherd dog called Fritz. They've got a German shepherd dog called Fritz. They've got a German shepherd dog called Fritz. The one called Sheba died. They know where things are in B&Q. They know where things are in B&Q. They know where things are in B&Q. And they've got the joy of sex video. If I were a linesman, I would execute defenders who applauded my offsides. They were due on the Crystal Maze, yeah, they were due to go on the Crystal Maze, yeah, they were due on the Crystal Maze, but they got mugged in Florida. They went up in a hot air balloon, they declared their love in a hot air balloon, yeah, they drank champagne in a hot air balloon and had a row on New Year's Eve. They've got nothing but total respect for, they've got nothing but total respect for, they've got nothing but total respect for Annie Lennox. And if I'd have known they were coming, I'd have slashed me wrists.